So again, good morning, especially for those who may be participating through the webcast or just listening on audio. Let me say, I'm Steve Huffner from the Moritz College of Law, and it's my privilege to be moderating this fourth panel of our two-day conference, the first panel of the day, and we'll be using the same format that we used yesterday. It's a great success. Yesterday, we had an opportunity to think particularly about the Vermont case and particularly about the Texas case and focus in on some of the interesting potential ramifications of those decisions. This morning, in our first panel, we're going to step back a level, and first we'll hear from Pam Carlin, who's going to share her thoughts about what these two cases together may suggest about the coherence or incoherence in the election law field. And then we'll ask Michael Solomini to share his thoughts with us about some of the ways in which the procedural posture in which these issues come before the court shape the doctrine. And after that, we'll have the opportunity to have Linda Greenhouse give her reactions, and then we'll open it up for the wide-ranging exchange that makes this event so rewarding. So first I'll invite Pam to start, and again, we're going to do the best we can to make this audible, not just to the people in the room, but to those who might be listening on an archive later.
Well, thanks very much, Steve. When I sat down to think about what the relationship between the two cases was, the place where I started, obviously, was the syllabi, which are kind of staggering, and I'm going to take a deep breath and then read to you the syllabi from the descriptions of the lineups in the syllabi in Randall against Sorrell and then in LULAC. This is Randall. Breyer J. announced the judgment of the court and delivered an opinion in which Robert C. J. joined, in which Alito joined as to all but parts 2B1 and 2B2. Alito J. filed an opinion concurring in part and concurring in the judgment. Kennedy filed an opinion concurring in the judgment. Thomas filed an opinion concurring in the judgment in which Scalia joined. Stevens filed a dissenting opinion. Souter J. filed a dissenting opinion, which Ginsburg joined, in which Stevens joined as to parts 2 and 3. Did you get that? Okay, good. Then I can go on to LULAC. LULAC is even better. Because every permutation that could be out there is there. Kennedy announced the judgment of the court and delivered an opinion of the court with respects to part 2A and 3, in which Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer joined, an opinion with respect to parts 1 and 4, in which Roberts and Alito joined, an opinion with respects to part 2B and 2C, which no one joined. An opinion with respect to part 2D, in which Souter and Ginsburg joined. Stevens filed an opinion concurring in part and dissenting in part, in which Breyer joined as to parts 1 and 2. Souter filed an opinion concurring in part and dissenting in part, in which Ginsburg joined. Breyer filed an opinion concurring in part and dissenting in part. Roberts filed an opinion concurring in the judgment in part and dissenting in part, in which Alito joined. Scalia filed an opinion concurring in the judgment in part and dissenting in part, in which Thomas joined, and in which Roberts and Alito joined as to part 3. You know that there's a problem when they have to give you this kind of level of precision of the opinions themselves, giving subparts and subparts so you can figure out who's joining what and who's not. So at the end of this, we had 200 pages of opinions, 12 separate opinions, every justice a winner, every justice a loser on something, and all you could confidently say about this is $200 for a state legislative candidate contribution is too low, and one district in Texas violates the Voting Rights Act. Now, this level of disagreement is not something new at the court, because if you go back and you look at the last campaign finance opinion of the Rehnquist court and the last redistricting opinion of the Rehnquist court, you see something almost identical to this, the same number of pages, the same number of misunderstandings and disagreements. And it's not even as if it's the court that's fractured. It's the individual justices who are fractured. And one of the kind of central elements of this paper is to point out that on a really quite critical issue, which is should the courts be engaged in judicial review, especially in order to assure competition and to disentrench the people in power, in the campaign finance cases, for example, Justice Rehnquist and Justice Thomas are quite insistent that courts have to get in there because the rules are clearly manufactured and manipulated by the people in power to keep themselves in power. And yet in redistricting, which is perhaps the most obvious way in which people who are in power can keep themselves in power, they say there is no justiciable standard that can authorize courts to intervene. So you might say, well, there's something quite similar about the two lines of cases and the problem in them. But like unhappy families in Anna Karenina, each of these doctrines is unhappy in its own way. And so part of what I try to do in this paper is to talk about that unhappiness and to explain where it came from. Let me say a little bit about the two major points I make on Randall against Sorrell. The first of these comes out of the structure of the statute in Sorrell, the Vermont Campaign Finance Act, which had essentially the same kind of structure for our purposes that the Federal Election Campaign Act of 1974, which gave rise to Buckley against Vallejo, a case with an equally complicated syllabus and no justice willing to put his name to the per curiam opinion. Back then, they still had shame about these things, I guess. But it was a statute that regulates both campaign expenditures by candidates and campaign contributions to candidates. The major thing that Buckley against Vallejo is now recognized for is the so-called campaign expenditure campaign contribution distinction, in which campaign expenditures basically can't be regulated very much by the government because that's speech of a particularly protected kind, but campaign contributions can, because after all, there's not much more communicative impact to giving a candidate $1 million than to giving him a dollar. They both communicate exactly the same thing, according to the court, and because there is an interest in preventing corruption, you can limit contributions even if you can't limit expenditures. The image I give in the paper is, besides the crack powder distinction in sentencing law, there is no distinction in constitutional law that has gotten more criticism than the campaign expenditure distinction. And after the lovely breakfast that you all provided, I feel bad about using this image that Sam and I have often used, which is to explain that the problem is if you limit the amount candidates can receive from any one contributor, but you don't limit the amount they can spend, it's kind of like sending them to the banquet table and saying you can eat all you want, but you have to bring it back teaspoon at a time. And this creates, obviously, as those of you who've ever been on a diet know, an obsession with consumption. You spend all of your time worrying about consuming and trying to get this stuff. And so this distinction, nobody likes it anymore, or at least nobody likes it except two justices on the Supreme Court, because one of the things we find out in Randall against Sorrell is there are only two justices, Justice Breyer and the Chief, who are willing to continue adhering to the crack powder, I mean the expenditure contribution distinction. But here's the problem. Although six and possibly seven of the justices on the Supreme Court agree that this distinction should be toppled, they fall into two camps. One group would ratchet down the level of scrutiny applied to expenditure limits to make it as easy to regulate expenditures as it is to regulate contributions, while the other group would ratchet up the level of scrutiny given to contributions, making it as difficult to regulate the amount of contributions as it now is to regulate the amount of expenditures. And this creates a kind of interesting dynamic, and I'll be very interested in sort of what Michael has to say about this, and then Linda, about whether or not to take another case when you have what is essentially a drunk man being propped up from two sides. And if you want to push him this way and the other side wants to push him that way, for those of you who are listening on the radio, I'm pushing my hands in opposite directions. There's this real question, well, what do you do about this? Do you try and wait until there's some more changed membership on the court? So that part, the kind of is the sick man of Europe or the sick man of constitutional law going to stay up there, is something that we might talk about later. The other interesting thing about the case is what I claim is some doctrinal development, or at least a kind of atmospheric or tonal change that I see in Justice Breyer's opinion, which is if you're going to use the First Amendment to regulate campaign finance, for most of the time it seemed that the way the First Amendment was being used was as a speech, the First Amendment speech restriction was where the action was. But Justice Breyer's opinion, I suggest, because it spends so much time talking about the effect of these contribution limits on the ability of political parties to target particular races and thereby to serve as intermediaries for voters who are concerned not just about who gets elected in their district, but about the legislative composition as a whole, I suggest that the move now in the First Amendment has been away from the speech element in campaign finance, perhaps, towards the association and competition element of the First Amendment. And this might actually be kind of promising. because talking about how the limits actually affect the structure of elections and the composition of legislative bodies rather than the individualized speech of particular campaign contributors might be a good way to go. And so that's kind of what I say about Randall against Sorrell in the written version of the paper. The last point I make there is that the court's competition rationale, this concern with political competition and the idea that campaign finance really has much to do with political competition, especially in legislative races, is sort of ironic because really most of the action there, most of the determinant of who's going to win an election does not depend so much on the money. Indeed, the money may follow who's more likely to win because the money is designed not to elect the candidate but to assure that the candidate, once elected, gives some access to the contributor. The irony, then, is that we know who's going to win most of these elections before we even know who the candidates are. And those of you who have a written version of the paper, there is a footnote to some of the work that was done by the Center for Voting and Democracy, in which they used to predict with an astonishing degree of accuracy the outcome of congressional elections 2 years beforehand, knowing nothing about who the two candidates were going to be, but knowing simply the share of the votes that each major party received in the last presidential election. And so if most of the districts are safe, it's really hard to see how campaign finance reform of any kind or judicial scrutiny of campaign reform legislation of any kind is going to change the competitive balance very much. The second part of the paper talks about LULAC against Perry. And here I start with what I think of in some ways as a joke, but actually a serious point as well. And that is, if you go back to 1812 and the redistricting of the Massachusetts state legislature, we get the name for our current term for manipulation of legislative lines, gerrymandering, from the name of the governor who sponsored and then signed into law the legislation allowing for the redistricting of the Massachusetts state legislature. And I suggest that maybe we should call the process of mid-district redistricting delayed redistricting because of Tom DeLay, who came up with the idea, well, perhaps didn't come up with it, but certainly took it to its highest art form, which is you redistrict as soon as you get power to change the composition of the legislature. And this actually is also a 19th century technique, which is one of the reasons I wasn't too sanguine that the Supreme Court was going to come up with a way of saying mid-district redistricting is unconstitutional, because we had a long and nasty history of this in the 19th century, where a party would get into power and would then just redistrict to retain its seats. Here, as in Randall against Sorrell, we see the same doctrinal deadlock, in a sense, which is we still have four justices who think that political gerrymandering is justiciable, and they still have perhaps three different standards for how you figure out which political gerrymanders are too much. We have at least three justices who think that political gerrymandering claims are never justiciable. I'm sorry, we have at least two justices who think they are never justiciable. We have one justice who thinks they're justiciable but still hasn't seen any standard for adjudicating the claims, but he wouldn't like to rule it out. This, in another context, is what Justice Scalia had referred to as the Supreme Court's never-say-never jurisprudence. And then we have two justices who just arrived on the Supreme Court, and perhaps people thought they were going to tell us whether they thought it was always, sometimes, or never justiciable. You know, A but not B, B but not C, A and C but not B. They refused to tell us anything, claiming in some way that I still have not figured out that the question whether the Texas political gerrymander violated the Constitution was not presented to the Supreme Court by a case in which the question presented was, does the Texas political gerrymander violate the Constitution? I just would love to hear what either of you thought or anybody in the audience thought was going on when Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito said the question of justiciability was not raised by the parties. It seems implicit in the claim that it violates the Constitution and that the judgment should be reversed, the last line of the brief, that you are claiming there's something justiciable here. But the Supreme Court ducked that question and made no headway whatsoever on the issue of political gerrymandering. Instead, What happened is that Justice Kennedy struck down the Texas re-redistricting on the grounds that the dismantling of a majority Latino district centered essentially on Laredo violated the Voting Rights Act. And what I claim, you know, I could have spent a lot of the paper talking about the Voting Rights Act itself and how that worked out, but I make two claims in the paper that I hope will spur discussion. The first of these is that the way Justice Kennedy explains why House District 23's evisceration violates the Voting Rights Act, the kind of analysis he uses there indicates what a representational harm theory might look like. And he's the one who's claiming, as soon as you give me a representational harm theory, then I could feel confident in adjudicating political gerrymandering cases, which is, here is an organic community that exists on the ground, not something artificial, that has been politically organized and galvanized and mobilized and is on the verge of getting a representative they want. They have been repeatedly showing with increasing vigor that they reject the representative who's in there. And someone comes in from the outside and says, no, you're going to keep this representative whom you have already repudiated. We know you don't want him, but we're going to make you keep him. And that seems to me to be, albeit not a comprehensive theory of representational harm, a theory of representational harm. And so part of the paper says, well, now Justice Kennedy has thought this up under the Voting Rights Act, to be sure, but perhaps he might think about how this theory of representational harm goes further. The second point I make in the paper is about the implications of the court striking down House District 23 for an issue that's likely to come before the court, and come before the court, as I think Michael probably mentioned with respect to his paper, very fast on direct appeal, and that is the constitutionality of the extensions and amendments of Section 5 and Section 203 of the Voting Rights Act by Congress earlier this year. And here, I note two things that are kind of interesting and perhaps unexpected in a way, and perhaps careless. It was the end of the term, the justices are writing fast, and they, you know, if they have to write six opinions in very few weeks, they don't have a lot of time to read their own opinions, let any problem anybody else's. But here are the two points. The first is, as far as I can recall, LULAC is the first time that Justice Kennedy has found a violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And he does it, and this is a man who several times wrote separate concurrences or dissents in which he said he wasn't sure the Voting Rights Act was constitutional. And he wasn't sure even if it was constitutional that it would be constitutional in cases where you didn't find purposeful racial discrimination. And so he may be indicating something about a move towards the center, right? The center on Voting Rights Act had been Justice O'Connor. She had been the pivotal vote in all of the voting rights cases over the last couple of years. And now she's gone, and he may be moving to occupy that center position, and it may be part of his general kind of move to the center. The second point comes from the Chief Justice's dissent. The Chief Justice dissented in LULAC on the grounds that the evisceration of the House District in Laredo was perfectly all right because there was the creation of another majority-minority district that extended from McAllen, which is on the Mexican border, up to Austin, which is essentially in the center of the state. This is the district that I tried, you know, I wanted to have my name attached to the district. So I tried to call it the Fajita District because it was long and thin, the Chief Justice and the district court, being more Anglo, I guess, in a sense, call it the Bacon Strip District instead. But the Chief said the creation of the Bacon Strip District was good enough. Then said, well, you know, it's all really sordid business, this divvying up by race, and I suggest we could have just stopped after this divvying us up. It's not the racial characteristic of this that's so sordid, it's the entire sordid process. But then he and Justice Alito joined an opinion by Justice Scalia suggesting that this incredibly ugly district that was quite sordid was required because Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act required the creation of another majority-minority district to compensate for the destruction of District 23. And in past cases, Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, first of all, had suggested the act was unconstitutional, but also had suggested that the act should only, that Section 5 could only serve as a compelling state interest to the extent that the act properly understood by them required creation of one of these districts. And so the question that I leave at the end of the paper is whether there's been some indication here that the vote
fact be a constitutional piece of legislation under congressional enforcement powers. And I'll just end with one last piece on this, and that is that Justice Kennedy's description of why House District 23 was required spent so much time talking about racial polarization in Texas and the long history of discrimination and how it had affected this community that finally was on the brink of electing a congressman of its own. It's going to be very hard for him to then come back with what Rick Hansen has called the whole Connor is dead problem when the Voting Rights Act gets in front of the court, the claim that things are so different in 2006 than they were in 1965 that the Voting Rights Act is no longer needed. So I'll stop there.
Great. Thank you. Let's pass the microphone over to Mr. Solomon.
I was just told that the microphone doesn't seem to be working, and the mute button might be on. Just check.
Do that again. Can you redo that?
Yeah, you can't redo it.
I think it's on the bottom.
And then you have to vote on an electronic machine after that.
Now it's not on. It was on. See, the on button's on.
Maybe the battery is
on. Something inside has died.
I bet the battery is dying.
Okay, well, on that controversial note, I'll try to get started here. First of all, I want to thank Ned Foley and all the other wonderful hosts here at Ohio State for inviting me to participate in this really wonderful symposium. And indeed, it's a hard act to follow Pam Carlin and Ned Foley and all the other great election law scholars here. I do want to, as Steve has already mentioned, take a slightly different tact here and talk about some of the procedures and processes and institutions that some of which are unique, that by which some of these, or many of which, of these election law cases are litigated at both the trial court level and the Supreme Court level, and just comment on kind of the significance of, spell out a little bit of what I see as the significance of that. So what, that there's, you know, these different processes, and I think it does arguably matter with just how the cases are postured, why, and how the Supreme Court takes the case is something that we've been talking about frequently. And perhaps, you know, shed light on the development of the doctrine for good or ill itself in the U.S. Supreme Court and indeed in the lower court. So, and what I'm talking about in particular, there's kind of a host of things, but the focal points would be, I guess, two focal points. One would be, and they've already been mentioned, is direct review statutes that Congress in various ways can goes outside the certiorari process and has a statute that we call a direct review statute, that the case, if it is appealed, goes up on direct review to the U.S. Supreme Court, and at least ostensibly the Supreme Court has to decide the case in some way and simply can't, you know, have the discretion to grant or deny certiorari. At least that's sort of the plain meaning of the statute. So that's one thing. The other thing closely related to that is that in some of these cases, Congress sets up a three-judge district court to adjudicate it at the trial level, and then there's a direct appeal from that if there's an appeal sought to the Supreme Court. So I'm going to talk about both those things. But before that, just to mention, Rick Hansen, in his book that came out, I guess, in 2003, he has an appendix at the end of the book that lists all the election law cases as he defines them from, like, 1900 to 2000 or something. Something like that, and then there's been, you know, a number of course, cases since then. And at least by my count, and I started counting actually for just no particular reason from 1980 to the present, just using Rick's data, about a third or fourth, somewhere around there, 35 to 40% of those cases involved three judge district courts at the trial level and/or direct review statutes. So it's not a trivial thing. I guess is what I'm trying to say. So okay, and I'm going to talk about Randall and LULAC to illustrate some of these. Kind of use them as case studies. So just on Randall, there's been a lot of talk, of course, about the Buckley and McConnell litigation, and just to quickly step back and look at those, as some of you know, I'm sure, but both those cases involved challenges to federal legislation, and Congress set up the direct review statutes to govern the expected constitutional attacks on those on the legislation. And why did they do that? Well, the legislative history talks a lot about in both those cases about expedited treatment. The idea was that it was in the public interest to have the constitutional litigation concluded in a rapid fashion, no matter how it came out, and the Supreme Court ought to quickly. Get the case, and so there's a big theme in that. I guess from a political science perspective, if you will, there's perhaps other rationales that might come up. What might be called their strategic behavior or strategic positioning by both opponents and by both supporters and opponents of the legislation in Congress. In other words, why was the special procedure set up in the first place? If there was nothing, it would normally go to like any other civil case in federal court, just go to a single federal district judge who had jurisdiction, appeal from that to the appropriate U.S. Court of Appeals, and then, on a writ of certiorari, one presumes to the U.S. Supreme Court, just like any other civil case. But no, they set up these special procedures. So the perceived need for expedited treatment is one thing. I guess the assumption is you can't have expedited treatment, or it's harder to get expedited treatment with a normal, the normal process. But there is some, evidence, you might say, of strategic positioning. In Buckley, for example, there's legislative history that says it's in the public interest to have, this quickly adjudicated. That's often cited, and the person who's quoted on that is Senator Buckley in Congress at the time, and of course he was the lead plaintiff, and the statute there actually listed people who could use this expedited process, one of whom was actually brought it or worded pretty broadly, but like it said, anyone who's eligible to vote for the president or something like that, and a couple other things. But nonetheless, it empowered Senator Buckley to bring the case. Not to get too technical, but there's some rightness issues in Buckley, and I guess there was some idea perhaps that if you didn't have that kind of statute, that the case, which was brought very quickly, like it was filed the day after the statute went into effect, that there might be rightness issues absent that statute, perhaps. So, well, what was the result of this? And I guess there's some, evidence that it did. For good or ill, it had some effect, the special statutes in McConnell and Buckley. There's a number of people have talked about the inadequate record, the arguably inadequate and thin record in Buckley perhaps led to the some of the holdings in that case, which have been, of course, the subject of much criticism. There's some evidence that Rakesson has talked about and written about the arguably hurried decision in Buckley and so forth. So that's a little bit on Buckley and McConnell. Let me talk about Randall, which may be may not seem like there's a link there, because Randall was an attack on a state statute, of course, and there was not any kind of special procedure in place, and it was just litigated in a normal fashion, indeed, in a rather leisurely fashion, I should say. There was a decision from the district court in Vermont in 2000. There was eventually a decision from this. There was an initial decision decision by the Second Circuit in 2002. Then they reheard, the panel reheard it and issued a decision, I guess, in 2004. There was a denial of rehearing en banc in 2005, and the U.S. Supreme Court granted cert and decided in 2006. So that's, you know, not whatever else you want to say, it's not quite expedited treatment. But nonetheless, I argue that it had a kind of a direct, for good or ill, it kind of had a direct review flavor to it. Let me just back up and say that you might wonder why, as we've been talking about with, post-Bush versus Gore litigation, why the Supreme Court took the case at all. Why didn't they just cert deny deny the case? As has been talked about already, the Second Circuit actually remanded on a particular issue of getting more of a record on the spending limits, an important part of the case. Why not, let the issue in general percolate or experiment, or there be some experimentation or percolation a little bit more? So just something Justice Stevens explicitly talks about in his dissent in Randall. So, but nonetheless, they sort of granted the case, and why is that? Well, I guess perhaps some obvious reasons. It was just a high profile issue that had a lot of attention both inside and outside the legal community. We talked about the cert pool a little bit yesterday, and maybe the one clerk, I guess it is one clerk, right, who reads it for the cert pool thought it was an interesting case and put it at the top of the top of the pile. But also there was a dissent by Judge Winter in the Second Circuit. There were published opinions on the denial of rehearing en banc and so forth. All those kind of gave an inevitability to the case getting to the U.S. Supreme Court. So I don't want to push the analogy too much, but it makes you wonder to compare the ostensibly normal route of litigation in Randall to the more rapid litigation in the prior to cases. Well, let me talk about LULAC now, and a bit more about the three-judge district court. As I'm sure some of you know, that the three-judge district court has a long and colorful history. It was created by the Congress in 1910 as a reaction to this very famous case of ex parte Young, and I guess the idea there was ex parte Young involved the U.S. Supreme Court hearing an appeal from a single district judge at the time, affirmed the granting of an injunction by a single district judge against the enforcement, of a state a statute. And it was very controversial at the time, and to kind of make a long and colorful story short, Congress reacted by setting up the statute where you had to have three judges to court adjudicate any such challenge with a direct appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Why did they do that? Well, not unlike the more modern special three direct review statutes that I mentioned, the expedited treatment was one thing. These are thought to be important cases, and they ought to be rapidly litigated. However, they come out. It was in the public interest to have them promptly litigated one way or the other. But also on the three-judge side, the idea was that three heads were better than one, and that it would get better. It would be better adjudicated by three judges rather than just one, and perhaps even that it would be perceived as more legitimate. However, it came out to have three federal judges litigate the case. I just pass those reasons on without necessarily endorsing them. That those pretty much were the reasons. So over the years, there's been a variety of complicated legal and policy issues that have come about regarding the three-judge district court. To make another long story short, the jurisdiction of the court was significantly limited in 1976, where it was limited to apportionment cases or reapportionment cases. And so that's how, that's the status of the statute. So a number of interesting issues in the interest of time. I'll just talk about two issues that come up with the three-judge district court, and that the two I'll talk about are the composition of the three-judge district court and then the summary dispositions of appeals from three-judge district court. So just on the first one, a lot of discussion about how these things are constituted under the statute. The chief judge of the circuit in which the suit is filed designates the people who sit on the three-judge district court, and typically it'll be the judge, the district judge, before whom the case is originally filed. One circuit judge. Under the statute, there has to be at least one circuit judge, and then one other judge, and typically it's another district judge. And as Pam Carlin and others have written about, there's at least, you know, there's at least anecdotal evidence over the years of at least in some cases chief judges stacking the panel to arguably achieve a favored result, favored, I guess, to the chief judge. So, for example, in LULAC, the three judges were Fifth Circuit Judge Patrick Higginbotham, who's a Republican appointee, Lee Rosenthal, who's a Republican appointee, and then John Ward, who's a Democratic appointee. And if you and you know, sure, that's a, you know, very crude measure of partisanship, which political scientists have rightly criticized, but nonetheless, it's widely used in scholarly and non-scholarly circles to look at the, you know, the political party of the appointing president, and you can work through and, you know, pose the question that, I guess, the very crude conventional wisdom was that the delay gerrymander favored the Republicans, and, you know, one might ask, did the Republican appointees at the lower court, you know, rule in favor of the Republicans? And I guess, you know, with the risk of oversimplifying, they more or less did. And then, and John Ward, the Democratic appointee, he dissented in part in a couple of lower court litigation in that case. And there might be, you know, at a very high level of generality, there might be some evidence of you know, partisan judicial decision making, but for reasons I explore further in the paper, I think it's very anecdotal evidence and pretty weak evidence. But there's, you know, there's something there. I don't think it can be totally ignored in LULAC or other three judge district court cases. Just real quick follow up to that. There's been some discussion in the literature about is that a good or bad the thing to, you know, to have the panel, the three-judge panel stacked. Indeed, some people have said that maybe you should deliberately have a, you know, at least one, you know, not have all the same appointees of the same party, that you should deliberately have, you know, one Democrat or one Republican. Other people have said, no, you shouldn't do that. That sends the wrong signal that you're, you know, politicizing the judiciary. So, okay, well, the second thing I wanted to talk about was the summary dispositions, and we've mentioned that already. So this is a real strange thing. These things come up on direct appeal from three-judge district courts, not under certiorari. So what does the court do? Well, it's typically done one of two things, and I guess the bottom line is that it has sort of treated it as the functional equivalent of a writ of certiorari. The reason being is that when the Supreme Court wants to kind of fully review such an appeal, they'll use this quaint phrase, they'll note probable jurisdiction and then have it fully briefed and oral argument pretty much like any other case, and that's what they did in LULAC. But when they don't basically want to hear the case, I mean, that's kind of my paraphrasing of it, they don't actually say that, but when they don't want to really hear the case, they'll summarily affirm, and they'll literally say that the judgment is affirmed, and the word summarily is kind of the adjective the legal community uses, and so it's been very confusing about how to interpret that. I guess the conventional wisdom, the summary affirmance, I mean, is that it does have some stare decisis, precedential, some precedential effect, but, you know, it's just this one-line affirmance. But how can that have precedential effect? Well, what's happened is that the justices themselves in later cases will examine the lower court opinion to determine the precedential effect, if you're following me. I mean, you know, it's typically they examine their own prior cases, which is fine, but here you have the strange situation, at least it's strange to me, of the Supreme Court examining and disputing about what the lower court meant. So it's very odd, and this happened in Cox, the Cox versus Larios case, which I think time will prevent me from talking about at any length, but Pam and others, Sam and others have talked about that, and the same thing happened. Larios was a case in between the VF case and LULAC. They summarily affirmed it, even though it's at the very least in tension with VF. Larios had basically said on the facts of that case that a political gerrymander was in fact justiciable, or at least the case is capable of being read that way, seems to be, you know, arguably in conflict with or tension with the Vieth case, and arguably a remand in light of Vieth might have been called for, but they just summarily affirmed it, and then there was a Justice Kennedy and Justice Stevens battle back and forth in LULAC about how to interpret that case, and they talk about the lower court opinion. So it's just very strange, it seems to me. Well, two more things real quick, and that is that the just on direct review statute, it's just as we've been talking about with various examples, it just to quote one person, that it seems to force the hand of the Supreme Court. It brings up cases, you know, indeed, rapidly most of the time, and ostensibly they don't have the discretion not to hear the case. They can have the summary affirmance, but that has all kinds of troubles, doctrinal, jurisprudential problems, as I've just identified, and so it just seems to me, you know, there's a problem there waiting to be cured in some way, and you can, I guess, there's perhaps several options what to do on that score. And one might be simply to just insist that the Supreme Court decide these appeals, you know, on the merits, so to spun really on the merits. I mean, just on their just fully brief them and decide the case. And, I mean, that would really force the hand, wouldn't it, of the Supreme Court to, you know, to fully decide all these cases. I guess an alternative might be to leave the present regime sort of more or less in place, but simply say that the summary dispositions of three-judge decisions don't have any precedential effect, that they would have kind of res judicata effect for that particular case, but simply not have any precedential effect. You might analogize them perhaps to unpublished dispositions, officially unpublished cases, that sort of thing. So that's just some thoughts about how to handle the summary disposition problem. I guess kind of more radically, what one might wonder whether these direct appeal statutes, direct review statutes, are really good on their own terms or achieving the result. If you just don't have them anymore, you could, you know, there would still, these cases would still be litigated, but just kind of as a normal civil a case would be, and then the other thing would be, you know, whether you should have, putting the direct review aspect to one side for a second, whether you should have three-judge district courts, or just, you know, there's no moral imperative to have such things. You could just have the things litigated like any other civil case before a single district judge. So I'll just leave it at that.
All right, thank you, Mike. Can we reach that over?
Let's see how this works.
Well, it's a pleasure for me to be here. I don't usually play in academic company, so it's fun to hear commentary on these issues, both substantive and procedural, that I live with and try to figure out on a kind of real-time, nitty-gritty basis. So just a couple comments on Pam's comments. On the potentially new rationale that's emerging from the Vermont case on the purpose of regulation of campaign finance, and if it's to protect through the associational right the health of political competition. Of course, this raises the problem that Rick Hasson talked about yesterday, which is, you know, how are judges or justices to evaluate that? How do they know? You know, the social science kind of assumptions in Breyer's take on the impact of the Vermont law on political competition have been obviously subject to some serious criticism. So, you know, should there be some sort of, you know, Daubert qualification of expert witnesses in campaign finance litigation? You know, I don't know, but it certainly does launch these judges, who of course never run for office themselves, into some landscape in which their expertise is a little dubious. On the Texas case, just to sort of combine the insights of Ellen's presentation yesterday, Pam, with your comments on you know how you understand Justice Kennedy in the distinction in the, you know, sort of very obviously different gut reaction phrased as judicial interpretation that he had of the Laredo district and the Bacon Strip district and so on. And we didn't talk much about the Martin Frost district, the dismantling of which, you know, didn't seem to bother him at all. So what's that about? And Ellen had, and you both talked about different concepts of representational harm. I mean, you might look at it, perhaps what's beneath the surface there is a reaction against the notion of political entitlement generally. And so the claims of the Democrats to, you know, the overall gerrymander claim of the Democrats, well, you know, who entitled them to make this claim when the shoe was on the other foot, you know, and they were riding high, you know, good for them. So, you know, there's just a sense that what is the authenticity of the representational harm claim here? You know, that's sort of, don't come to us to kind of entrench your claim of entitlement into constitutional law, basically. And so the difference perhaps between the Laredo district and the Bacon Strip district is, as you know, Ellen explained yesterday, the Laredo district had become a thriving Latino political entity on the verge of kind of self-earned success, and so was entitled to, under the jingles factors, but on a more emotional level, you know, to be respected as such, whereas the Austin to McAllen district was superimposed for the sake of convenience and with the, you know, assumption that this would somehow pass muster because of its ethnic composition. Without that background, you know, didn't fly with Kennedy, and so just leaving the question, looking ahead to the challenges to the constitutionality of Section 5, I wonder if the Scalia four, Scalia, Thomas, and Robertson Alito, blessing that district as serving the compelling state interest of living up to the state's Section 5 obligations against non-retrogression overall kind of backs them into a corner in terms of supporting Section 5 when those cases inevitably reach the court. To turn to Michael's paper, I found it really interesting because I do live with the cert and the jurisdictional statement process on a day-to-day basis and try to make my own educated guesses about what the court is up to, because I'm going to have to do an awfully fast turnaround and not, you know, not present a paper some months later at a conference. So I have a stake in trying to gain a rough understanding of this. In terms of the three-judge court expedited review process that was set up under BICRA, you mentioned in the paper, I'm not sure you gave it in your oral presentation, that this, in fact, might have been an implicit part of the deal by which BICRA passed Congress. And I think that is a really interesting point that I think law professors and political scientists could profitably take a look at, which is the whole relationship between the court and Congress in terms of passing measures of dubious or at least questionable, challengeable constitutionality, and kind of passing the buck by saying, we will guarantee Supreme Court review. You may have your doubts about this bill, but don't worry, we're going to get it right up to the Supreme Court. And this extends far beyond the voting rights area. I mean, just a couple I could think of off the top of my head. I mean, the Graham Rudman budget measure, you know, back 20 years ago, more recently the line item veto. And you know, some of these do raise Article III standing issues and ripeness issues, as the first line item veto case showed us. You can't just jump over, you know, Article III requirements by passing this, but they, you know, gave it a good college try. And a really weird one was the Communications Decency Act. Now, why on earth would this law that seeks to regulate the internet need mandatory expedited Supreme Court review? I mean, what was the emergency that caused the CDA to be put on this kind of fast track? Well, it was part of the deal, because Congress at that time felt an intense political need to pass this bill, because we're against pornography on the internet and we need to send these press releases out to our constituents. But a good number of them had their constitutional doubts about this bill, as indeed, as you recall, it was overturned by the Supreme Court by a vote of 9-0. So their concerns were well-founded. So the sponsor said, don't worry about it, we're going to get it right up to the court. So I think it's just a fertile ground of academic study that I think has been ignored by many people. And one problem that it raises, and you alluded to this, Mike, is it deprives the court of the benefit of a good factual record in a lot of instances. Now, in the Communications Decency Act case, there was an extensive record made by the ACLU plaintiffs in the three-judge court in Philadelphia. And obviously there's an effort in a lot of these cases to make a good record, and the BICRA record was huge. But you're dealing with facial challenges. Of course, BICRA was really odd because it was a facial challenge, you can't really say it was a pre-enforcement challenge, because by the time they decided it, the law was in effect. So there was this disconnect. There was a kind of an intellectual game that was being played as a facial challenge, but yet, you know, it was working on the ground. So that's another strange aspect of it. On the Vermont case, as you mentioned in the paper, and I think you alluded to one, it came to the court in a strange posture. It was an ordinary cert case, but a number of parties who you would have expected to not be in such a rush for Supreme Court review, because it was a remand, nonetheless essentially acquiesced in cert or urged the court to grant cert. And so the question is, why is this? Didn't they realize there was a high probability of reversal, that this was a very edgy statute? And I think that leads to the observation that, you know, what you see is not necessarily what you get in the way parties to a case frame their responses to cert, because in this case you had the National Voting Rights Institute, a very interesting outfit in Boston that's foundation supported and whose mission is to get Buckley against Valeo overturned, or at least, and I don't mean to say this cynically because I like them, but, you know, at least to keep the funding coming. So it was really important to them, I think, to get this case granted on the merits and to kind of tee up the issue in the public eye. And I've often observed that the impact of the court granting cert in a case, whether it's campaign finance, whether it's assisted suicide, you know, whatever it is, issues that have been of extreme interest to the pre-existing interested communities, the mere grant of cert really has the effect of putting something on the country's agenda at large. I mean, getting it on the cover of news magazines and so on. So when you have special interest groups, and I don't mean that in a derogatory sense, but just, you know, groups that have an interest in something more than just the outcome of a particular piece of litigation, but are doing strategic litigation, it's sometimes in their interest to get sued, even if they are going to lose. Or maybe they're so self-deluded, or they really persuaded themselves so much of their own arguments that they really did believe that the expenditure limitations of Buckley were ripe for falling. There's another game that's played in teeing cases up for cert, and that I think is the dissent from denial of rehearing on the circuit level. And when you get key judges, or judges that are well known to the court or highly respected by the court or whatever, I mean, sometimes it's an Alex Kaczynski in the Vermont case, if I'm not misremembering this, I think it was Guido Calabresi wrote a dissent from the denial of rehearing that was essentially a cert petition. You know, I think he explicitly said the court's going to have to figure this out sooner rather than later, and they might as well do it sooner. You know, that's all part of the picture that plays into whether the court's going to take a case. And when I look at a cert petition and I look at the appendix and I see something like this going on, you know, it goes on my quite likely list myself, so I assume that's the same thing that goes on in the cert pool and goes on upstairs. On the partisan nature of the three-judge courts, I just want to weigh in here and say that I actually think it's a bum rap on the three-judge court that decided LULAC. I think Lee Rosenthal, whom I know, even though she was appointed, I think, by the first President Bush, I mean, she is not a partisan person, and I think it's you know, kind of unfair. And I think Patrick Higginbotham is also, you know, entitled to a presumption that he didn't act in a partisan way. I think it would be disastrous for the judicial system if we ever had an overt requirement that on three-judge courts that have a political balance, because I think, you know, any of us who work in this area have to assume as a working assumption, even if it's sometimes refuted by the facts, that judges are going to come to their work without partisan labels. And I'd hate for anything to be built in explicitly that would tell the citizens at large, you know, otherwise. My last comment is on the summary affirmances. Also just raises a sort of interesting Supreme Court watch question of summary dispositions per curiam of just ordinary cert petitions. And that was a practice that was quite common in the 80s. It was came under a lot of dispute within the conference. I think Justice Stevens really disliked it. Justice Marshall really disliked it, and it kind of fell away over a period of time. And now I've noticed in the last year or two, it seems to be coming back. And so that's just, I'll just flag that for people that like to follow this stuff as something that might be worth looking at. It's happened a fair amount in summary reversals from cert petitions filed by the Attorney General of California appealing criminal opinions by the Ninth Circuit. But it's happened in a couple of other contexts too, and just kind of something worth watching as yet something else to watch in the new Roberts Court. Thanks.
Thank you. With that, let me ask Michael and Pam, do either of you have reactions, responses, or do you have other questions?
Yes, three very brief observations.
One is on the composition of the three-judge courts. The work that I did that talks about the composition was talking about during the desegregation days, in which it was very clear, I think, that in case after case, the Court of Appeals judge in the Old Fifth, who was assigned to all of those cases, was Wisdom, Tuttle, Reeves, or Brown, and Ben Cameron, who was a quite notorious racist judge on the Fifth Circuit from Mississippi, was never assigned, even though the normal tradition is to assign a judge from within the state as well as the circuit as the circuit judge. I don't think anybody has suggested in the last, in the last couple of decades that there's been that kind of manipulation. In part because I think it was never partisan. It was based on a sort of outcome issue that had to do with the enforcement of Brown. The second point, is about the direct review flavor in Sorrell. I think some of this, and this ties in with something Linda was saying, may be about a very different kind of expositional style between Justice Breyer on the one hand and Justice Kennedy on the other hand, which is Justice Breyer's opinions in the election law area, and if you think back to the North Carolina redistricting easily against Cromartie's like this as well, read very much, they are very much kind of Court of Appeals style decisions in which he goes through the facts in a very kind of painstaking way, and then does a kind of very casual theoretical empiricism. So the Dober idea is kind of puzzling for him because he doesn't, you know, he sits there and he kind of does things on a calculator and then says, well, you know, there's been this change and this is really, you know, there's that odd part in Sorrell where he says, well, per citizen, it's 0.0006 cents per vote per citizen in Missouri, but point out, you know, so one might say this and one might say that, and then you want to say in a sort of bar, well, my God, what's going on here? Right, and so his expositional style is this one of kind of nitpicky, isn't this interesting, slightly attention deficit disorder way of thinking about the case. On the other hand, Justice Kennedy is a big storyteller, and it is his gut instinct. And the larger point to draw out of this gut instinct point is, as long as you have so many doctrines floating around that could be used theoretically to strike down some part of a plan, if some justice has a gut feeling there's something bad about it, that will happen, you know. And so in Cox against Larius, in the paper that Sam and I did a couple of years ago, we suggest court didn't like that political gerrymander, but having just said we're not deciding political gerrymander cases, they said, well, actually, although we used to say a 10% deviation was good, well, now we're going to say this 9.9 isn't good. So the second point is, you know, the expositional styles of the justices tie in with this doctrinal issue. And the third is a question about whether or not the court is, when they try to think about political competition, whether they're thinking about bottom up or top down. The problem, of course, is all districting is top down in some sense. It's all the state deciding how to allocate people. And so coming up with a bottom up theory of which districts are entitled to representation in a system in which it's a top down imposition of representation is going to be very hard for the court. And so we may end up staying in this kind of gut instinct, you know, seat of the pants way of adjudicating the cases for a very long time.
Just a couple comments. A bit more on the three-judge district court. Over the years, the Supreme Court itself and the lower federal court judiciary came to dislike the three-judge district court, or certainly most of them. The Supreme Court, I mean, was quite overt about this. They didn't like the burden of the direct appeals, you know, even though many of them were summarily affirmed, to be sure, summarily disposed of. They I'm talking about in the 60s and 70s, there were a lot, huge numbers of direct appeals, I guess, because of litigation during the civil rights era and for other reasons, not just reapportionment cases. So, you know, ex parte Young type of cases. So the Supreme Court itself and through the Judicial Conference of the United States, I guess you might say, and then the American Law Institute and other people lobby basically Congress to repeal it. The lower federal judges, many of them didn't like it either because of the awkward and kind of convoluted nature of it, and it was different, obviously, than having just a single district judge litigate it. You had, you know, three judges coming together, and at least, you know, certainly not for every single, I guess, you know, not everyone felt awkward about that, but there was a, you know, a general feeling that among many federal judges themselves, never mind other people, that was just kind of a weird and awkward arrangement that simply wasn't necessary, at least in the minds of some. So during the 60s and early 70s, there was a push just to eliminate it entirely, the three-judge district court. And there was a compromise of sorts in 1976 that I already ascribed to eliminate it, except for reapportionment cases. Why was that left? Well, the legislative history, at least the way I read, is not crystal clear on that. What is said in there is that the reapportionment cases are important, quote unquote. That's what the legislative history says, that they're important and there are not so many of them in any case, which I'm not sure is exactly true. But that's the reasons that were given in 1976. Still, you know, Congress, as we've talked about with McConnell and other things, have periodically set up separate three-judge district courts to deal with non-reapportionment issues. So we're kind of got to be careful about which types of three-judge district courts we're talking about. The other thing links to what Richard and others were talking about yesterday with the Wisconsin Right to Life, that it does seem to me that the three-judge district court is kind of, and direct appeals indeed, is kind of forcing the hand of the court, and I guess you can debate whether that's a good or bad thing, that it's forcing the hand. But I think descriptively, that's sort of what it's doing, and we see that the court doing a number of things to kind of, you know, regain the discretion, I suppose, is one way to do it. Summary affirmances is one, you know, quickly disposing of the Wisconsin case on very narrow grounds is another, because they know that these, you know, direct appeals, both with the BCRA and other things, are going to be coming back. On the other hand, you know, I know there's going to be, I presume, a direct appeal of the challenge to the renewal of the Voting Rights Act, and I don't, you know, it's going to be tough for them to you know, summarily affirm. I don't know. Maybe they, assuming it's upheld at lower court, you know, would they just summarily affirm that? I don't know. It seemed to be a tough call to, you know, to do that with such an important case.
Well, let's get some broader reactions. Ellen?
I wanted to pick up on something Linda and Pam said about Justice Scalia's opinion, joined by the Chief, and then sort of take on what Justice Kennedy had to say in Luwak. And yesterday, Rick Pildes, who may not be up yet, accused me of, I guess, some unfounded optimism. So I think I'm going to take a more natural or comfortable role and express some pessimism right now about whether the justices who articulated Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act as being a compelling interest in a case where it didn't matter about a statute that's no longer going to apply in its current form is something that they're going to see as backing them into a corner, because I don't see that at all. I think nothing. It's interesting that they articulated finally that this is a compelling interest, given that Scalia in particular had opportunities to do that previously and didn't. And maybe he didn't have to on other cases. So I think it is interesting that he says it here and that we do have something that's compelling and that's necessary, and gee, that's nice, for this case and this case only and never again, is what I'm thinking is going on. And not unlike the preservation of South Carolina versus Katzenbach in the Bernie cases, where I wonder that the court cites the record under the 65 Act, not because it's just a great example of a good record that justifies congressional action, but because it's the only example that will ever meet the standard that the court really is putting forward. So I'm concerned. I wouldn't take too much. I don't know what the court will do, but I wouldn't read that Luwak is, you know, in the tea leaves, that this is all going to be okay. Scalia doesn't cite City of Rome, I think, when he says this. I mean, he's looking at the 65 Act, he's looking at the 82 Act. I don't see them being constrained by the 2006-2007 reauthorization because of anything they said here. And related to that, I think it's interesting and important that Justice Kennedy cites the history of discrimination and the way he deals with that in articulating the Section 2 injury. And I think it's really interesting that he finds a Section 2 injury, and I'd like to talk to you more about whether the representational harm you see him articulating is the one that I see him articulating, and maybe it is. I don't think anything about that's going to make him feel locked in or suggest that he's going to uphold Section 5, in part because of the discussion that, hey, we don't need Section 5 because we got Section 2, and look at that, I can strike it down on that, and it's a nationwide statute, and it's not singling anybody out. And it doesn't have this, you know, odd coverage formula and this odd burden shifting procedure that, you know, I don't know that he's going to embrace. And in saying that, I would add that I think if I had a bet on it, yeah, I think he probably will uphold it because he likes to go to Austria in the summer, and I think, you know, he wants people to be nice to him there, which, you know, and I think that's part of it. I mean, and I think it's a big deal to strike this thing down, but I don't think he's going to feel like I struck down District 23 and hence Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act is, you know, henceforth, good legislation.
Yeah, no, I would never claim something quite that mechanical. And I think the bottom line on this is not that they've backed themselves into a corner, because they never backed themselves into a corner in that sense.
I think it's something a little bit different, which is they're setting themselves up. And here, I think the more important opinion, almost in a way, than Justice Scalia's opinion in Lulac is his opinion at the same time, same term in United States against Goodman, United States against Georgia and Goodman against Georgia, which is he can then set himself up to say, yes, the Voting Rights Act is constitutional, but only when it's applied in the following sorts of ways. And if I had to guess what this Supreme Court will do with Section 5 when it goes back up, it's they'll affirm the constitutionality in a very narrow way, and then they'll start nibbling away again in the same way they did in Georgia against Ashcroft and the like on what the precise meaning of retrogression is. Because precisely for the reason you say, which is the symbolic nature of coming in and saying, we are striking down the Voting Rights Act of 1965 as amended and extended by Congress in the Rosa Parks, Fannie Lou Hamer, Coretta Scott King Act of 2007. You can see what the headline looks like. And a headline like that, you go to Austria and, you know, no more Sound of Music for you. So I don't think that what they have done here is box themselves into a corner. I think what they have done is set themselves up so that if somebody does want to dissent from the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act when the issue comes back up there, they will not be able to do it by screaming at Justice Scalia or Justice Kennedy, how could you switch in this case from your consistent position that this act is constitutionally dubious to something that upholds it, that it gives them actually more weasel room to uphold the act and yet whittle away at the edges. That's all. Yes.
Heather and Richard and Sam on deck.
So actually, I don't want to add to it because I was going to say exactly that. I think that that the reason why we're seeing these odd moments where Kennedy and Scalia and Thomas are suddenly comfortable with the Voting Rights Act is that they've actually been able to rewrite the statute so effectively in private. And the only thing that pushes just against that is just the fact that Congress managed this time to sort of say, no, you've rewritten it too much, you've gone too far. But given the political dynamics of that renewal, I just think it's very hard for Congress to correct it on a regular basis.
The interesting thing is the Bossier Parish fix, as opposed to the Georgia against Ashcroft fix, the Bossier Parish fix does exactly what Scalia thinks you ought to do, because the only cases that the Bossier Parish fix deals with are ones where there's intentional discrimination that's not retrogressive. But he just said in Goodman that Congress has essentially plenary power to come up with a remedy there, so all you have there is the obligation that you come in and show it's not intentionally discriminatory, and that the burden of proof is on you to disprove intentional discrimination. And so I think the Georgia against Ashcroft fix is a problem. This court, I think, will come up with some way of fixing the fix. On Bossier Parish, it's hard to see even what the argument looks like as to why Congress, having said we want all 15th Amendment violations and 14th Amendment violations to lead to objections, it's really hard to see why the court would have a problem.
Yeah, so I just wanted to just ask one additional question, which is, you know, there's always this difference between what the court says and what happens on the ground. So, you know, I once went to the National Conference of State Legislators where the firm I was working for was trying to explain to them what Shaw meant, and, you know, we showed them pictures. This kind of district is bad. This kind of district is, you know, it wasn't the sort of nuanced, is an expressive harm analysis that we've been sort of putting
in. The thing was, we say community of interest.
Right.
That for me. Of interest.
And you know, the way that Shaw, I mean, there's two ways of reading Shaw's and being internalized. Either people stopped drawing those districts or they understood that the court was withdrawing. But in either case, you know, the signals that sort of come to the ground are much broader. So I wonder, even if the court does this kind of nibbling at the edges, trimming back, if at the end of the day, the Voting Rights Act passage will still actually have some, will still matter a bit on the ground, because just the internalization, it's too subtle or too nuanced at this point, and state legislators are going to want confidence and.
Well, I mean, one of the things there is that it was very hard to get this into the legislative history in the form we wanted, because it's very hard to get people to say this on the record. But there are a lot of people in southern jurisdictions who like having Section 5 because it gives them political cover to do what they would like to do anyway, or what they feel sort of morally obligated in some sense to do anyway. Because you can say, it's not me giving this to them. The devil in Washington made me do it. And so I think right now, especially with this Justice Department and Section 5,
The major effect of Section 5 is not that things get objected to. The major effect is people say it's not worth the hassle, or people say this will be objected to, even though if they were sophisticated, they know it wouldn't be, and therefore we won't do it.
Yeah. Richard.
Yeah, my questions or points more to the procedural issues. In particular, I think maybe not so much a defense of three judge courts as the defense of expedited procedures, particularly in the campaign finance case, particularly, I guess, in federal cases. I mean, after all, you're talking about, take FICA and VICRA as the two big examples, dramatic, total in the first case and significant in the second case, rewriting of the rules of the game. I mean, it reminds me of Ned's paper per se about the value of clarification before the game begins rather than afterwards. And I think as early as possible, you need to get all these questions, not just that they're adopting things they know are unconstitutional, but adopting, or they're consciously pushing limits, especially now given the state of doctrine, as Pam has pointed out, no one knows what's constitutional at the time. Or no one, some issues never came up before, but beyond that, even where the issues have come up, the doctrines are particularly murky, so it strikes me as not untoward and probably appropriate that these things get resolved as early as possible before the game begins. And there, I think, being both the special procedures, I mean, just in terms of expedition, I'll hold off the quality over for a second, expedition, both the FICA and VICRA ones work. I mean, again, elections never stop, like fundraising never stops, but in some sense, there's an informal sense that the odd-numbered year is low year, and the even-numbered year is high year. And Buckley was decided in January of 1976, and things were a little slower then, just as they were gearing up. And VICRA, remember, VICRA was passed in March of 02, but didn't take effect until January 1 of 03. So they really had 9 months to work on it, to get it going. That was decided in December of 03. So again, they were living under it, but in some sense, the high gear wouldn't have kicked in. So I think it was seen as a success in terms of getting it done early enough in the game that the rules of the game didn't get rewritten and they were appropriate and they were confirmed at the right time. So that's sort of a pitch for why, consistent with the administration values, you want to get this done early, although I don't have any sense of the three-judge courts. It's sort of the case that I know best, VICRA. The three-judge court makes a mockery of the whole thing. I mean, 1,700 pages, three judges, four opinions. It even failed to do what it was supposed to do, which is find facts, although, in fact, the Supreme Court cherry-picks all the facts.
Yeah, you could look through there and there were some facts.
Right, no, but you found your own facts, and somebody used Colicatelli's facts, and somebody else uses Anderson's facts. But it failed in the sense of creating a coherent record, but it succeeded in moving everything along in a way in which you can get good resolution. Also, the question is, will this quality suck, which I guess Rick Hassan said about Buckley. I'm not so sure. I mean, again, as we talked about yesterday and today, to me it seems that, A, there are profound philosophical differences, both in society at large and among the courts, so that you may not get a movement, and in fact, you may of necessity get compromised verdicts in these things. Plus, there's deep uncertainty as to how it's all going to work. I mean, sort of the dueling experts. And Buckley, of course, we had never tried anything like this before. So I think if you take together the deep divisions on philosophy and normative values and the total uncertainty as to what's going to happen, I don't think if you gave him another year, he would necessarily have gotten a better opinion. You know, it's had some things are good, some things are bad. And kind of say the same thing about VICRA, the same deep divide about the tension between regulation and freedom of speech, the same uncertainty as to what's going to happen, the same sense of how, it's more a sense of, I think Rick yesterday refers to the adaptation effect, how are people going to cope? And that's the real thing, is that there's a sort of a serious problem here is that the rules don't tell us what they're going to do under the next set of rules. So not sure that it's, that again, they've done such a bad job on all this, even if I don't like the job they've done, in the sense that it's, you know, it's hard to argue about it. And then just one, note about Randall. Sort of 2 points. One is, why were they so stupid, that is to say the advocates, in rushing this case forward? The only thing I can think of, course, is remember the timing. When the Second Circuit denied a hearing on bank, it was February of 2005, and Justice O'Connor was still on the court, and there was no hint she was retiring. And I think if you think this following on McConnell, and the swing in the court, or the apparent swing in the court, with O'Connor joining Stevens in writing the majority opinion, and you take Breyer's statements, which only Breyer writes the majority opinion, I was even sad with using Breyer's language. You have a sense that this might have been the moment to get these issues forward. They probably were intoxicated by the success in the Second Circuit and the whole idea of actually getting any court in America. It was the first time that any court in America had, since 1975, had upheld a spending limit on a candidate. And maybe just wanting to lock that in, I don't know if they would have gotten O'Connor State on the court, but you can sort of see where where they were still sort of counting on the McConnell court to still be in existence, and indeed, procedurally, the history is what probably killed them. As Michael points out, the Second Circuit decided this case in October of 2002, 2-1 vote, long dissent by Ralph K. Winter, petition for rehearing on that, it's pending, the panel pulls it back, and then sits for 2 full years on this case, and then re-releases it, almost unchanged, either being accepted that the majority has now salted it with references to McConnell, which came in the interim, and then comes down in the fall of 2004, and then being bagged, it goes through the non-rehearing on bag. So I think, if, in some ways, if they had moved faster, maybe you would have gotten it further. I know the result would have been different, but you could sort of see why they were doing it. And one final little thing, Calabresi actually concurred in the non-rehearing on bag. Because he wanted the case to go up. So, but you had these wildly emotional dissents, really, in addition to having Winter's very opinion. I forget either Jacobs or Cabranes wrote something like, this is the equivalent of a state adopting titles of nobility. I mean, there was a sense of this, the upholding of spending limits was so inconsistent with our fundamental values, that as if they adopted the titles of nobility, but provided for corruption of law. And so... Exactly. So the sense from the part of the dissenters that this thing was just an unbelievably awful decision. So I don't know. That part of the odd sequence history that is.
It just, I agree with you that the court's behavior in BCRA is worthy of some, you know, pat on the back in part because, you know, the court is so loath to depart from its usual schedule, which is, you know, published 2 years in advance and never deviated from, and when they set the expedited argument the week after Labor Day, not only signaled that they, you know, they were respecting Congress and they knew it was important, but I think it had the effect of letting all the justices really pay attention to this case and this case only. And that's a real luxury. I mean, usually they're balancing, you know, 10 or 12 merits arguments in a sitting, and this is the only thing they needed to think about at the crucial period, which is preparing for argument and at conference. And so I think it did have that good effect.
Quality to what will the court do when it grows up. Ford and Lumac had a line that I think was exactly right. They said, this doesn't look like a race case to us. And that's why they were very dismissive throughout that opinion of the voting rights claims. They didn't really engage the voting rights claims the way that the Supreme Court did. They just said, this doesn't look like a race case. And you read Kennedy's opinion on Lumac, you know, on the voting rights part, and it has the same feature, I think, as Cosby Lyrics. It has the feature of finding an expedient for something that feels wrong at the gut level, where there is no doctrine that he is comfortable with. Now, I think the one major development out of all these cases, out of McConnell, Randall, Veith, and then Lulac, is that different constellations of justices have looked at different points for rationales that can get them through this. And through all of them, in some kind, they recognize that they all fit together somehow, even though they're doctors. And there's two basic approaches, I think, that are coming at it. One is a complete deference to the political process. We're getting back at it. And if they go that route, they're going to have to confront Frankfurt. They're going to have to revisit the base on what was made in Baker versus Carr. And that's, I think, on the table right now. And we should understand that to be on the table. The other is that they see themselves as police of the integrity of the political process. And that's a far different institutional role for the courts, and one that doesn't, in my view, turn on the application of specific doctrines and voting rights or anything else. They have an institutional obligation to protect the integrity of courts. I think that you know, I read this from the competition standpoint. I think that they have a way of policing the competition point if they want to go there. And that is to do the same thing here that they do in economic markets with antitrust background, just to say, there's a lot of range of what can be the economic arrangements and the political arrangements. We're going to police against the excessive and self-serving behavior, which is basically what antitrust law is. They could go there. I have no sense that they want to go there. Some of them, I think Breyer wants to end up there. I think Scalia sometimes thinks that they might be the place to end up. But I think that that's what's on the table right now, and these four opinions set up the poles of this debate, and to place too much weight on how they're playing out the doctrines while they figure out where they want to be when they grow up in this area is missing the picture.
That's a great place to transition to our concluding roundtable. So let me thank the panelists who participated in this panel for another very provocative session. Thank all three of you. Let me encourage everyone to stay close. We'll take a brief break, but try and get back closer to schedule with just, you know, 10 or 12 minutes or so.
Thank you. another battery around?
Thank you.
some more. I can't stay for the lunch afterwards. I think you can't either, right?
No, I have to leave at 11:30, so I'll stay for
its own interesting dimension of this. Pam's always got a nice global perspective on stuff. And having you being able to contribute also a really comprehensive perspective of how the court operates completely. It does really seem like they keep doing this for one, this right only kind of decision, even though they don't say it. Well, I mean, I guess I'd had a little contact with them when I was with Laurel when I was working in the Senate, but not much. But when they moved back here, mutual friends hosted a reception to welcome them back to town, and we met them there and quickly discovered that our kids were in the same preschool. So, yeah. So I must see Laurel like several times a week. Well, it depends on whether we get them. Yeah.
Are these two women back here Florida people?
I don't know.
Get us on. Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started for our concluding roundtable. Before we do that, let me say a couple of quick things by way of sort of administration. If you're seeing a red umbrella at your place, that's a parting gift from Moritz College of Law to you. Maybe it will be right. Maybe it'll be useful, unfortunately, on this somewhat rainy morning. And if you don't happen to see a red parting gift, I think we hopefully have enough for everybody that may be out there. So you're welcome to a umbrella. It will
take somebody else's umbrella.
No, there's, you know, right. It's a, we're a red, you know, we were a red state long before we were a red state, or we were a red university long before we were a red.
When you open it, it's actually scarlet and gray, right? It's,
yes. Yeah, okay. So it's a Buckeye. It's a, the other thing is this roundtable, designed to be an informal kind of gathering of thoughts based on what we've heard yesterday and today, very informal, will conclude the proceedings. But if people have later flights and want to just go walk across the street to a restaurant and schmooze some more, welcome to that. Don't feel obligated to do that. It's not part of the official proceedings, but I think some of us will go grab a bite to eat, and everyone is obviously welcome to join in if you'd like to do that. And we'll just, we've got a new feature here at Moritz where there's a gateway construction that has occurred in the last year or so, I think even since the previous conference. And we've got some actually decent restaurants now in our neighborhood, which we didn't before. So that's a good thing. The really bad thing, unfortunately, is Rick Pildes is very much under the weather this morning. We did him in yesterday. He was kind enough to come to the symposium, even though he's on antibiotics and suffering. But his enthusiastic participation yesterday, taxed his system. So he cannot deliver his paper, and he's Rick, and he does a great job, particularly in concluding roundtable. So no one can fill his shoes. But I can't resist the microphone and the opportunity to at least follow up a little bit on what Sam was just saying, as Steve said. That was a great segue into this roundtable discussion. So I'll say something very briefly, then Heather will speak, then Michael, and then Dan, and then we'll have a full free-for-all. I had been thinking this morning in my own, trying to organize what has happened the last couple of days and put a slightly different verbiage on, I think, similar to what Sam was saying. I put personnel labels on it in terms of the justices. It seems to me we're at a stage where there is a well-articulated Scalia jurisprudence on election law that maps out in districting, in campaign finance, in the Bush versus Gore area, even potentially in equal protection. And, you know, that's up there. And then there's a Breyer jurisprudence that's mapped out, well-developed in active liberty and in his cases. But what we don't have is Kennedy committing himself to a jurisprudence. He's acting intuitionistically or impressionistically, gut reactions, as various people have said. And so one open question is he going to develop his own jurisprudence, his own theory, or is he going to fall into the gravitational orbit of Scalia on the one hand or Breyer on the other hand? I think both are still open possibilities. I think he could fall into the Breyer orbit. I think he could fall into the Scalia orbit, depending upon how things develop. And then I think the other interesting open question is whether Roberts more likely than Alito, but either one of them may develop their own competing jurisprudence of election law that might fall somewhere in between Scalia on the one side and Breyer on the other, and then whether Kennedy would either gravitate to that middle position if it becomes that or help formulate that position is still an open question. It's obviously different. The spectrum is narrower than it might otherwise be. I think the range between Scalia and Breyer is narrower and different than the full range between Scalia on the one hand and even Stevens or Souter or earlier justices like Brennan. I don't think, you know, we're ever going to have a controlling Souter jurisprudence. It'll be out there. So I think the future lies within the range between Scalia on the one hand, and Thomas shares that, and I think either one of them may develop that vision. Breyer will continue to try to develop his own vision, and I think it will be interesting to see whether Kennedy develops a vision of his own or falls in the gravitational orbit of one or the other, or if there is this Roberts-Alito alternative vision. And it is too early to say. It's a court still learning itself, and I don't really have anything more to contribute to that, except I think that's a different way of saying something like what Sam was saying, but just with different labels attached. So with that brief observation, I want to turn the microphone over to Heather.
So, you know, you always reach a point in a symposium, as with faculty meetings, when there's a moment when everything has been said, but not everyone has said it. And I have a small worry that we have reached that point in the symposium, and that's in part due to the inadequacies of the opinions of this year. There's just not a lot of really wonderful things to say about them. So let me just say that I agree with the comments made in various places that we are in what I called in a year or 2 years ago when we met at Penn, a doctrinal interregnum, and the court is still feeling its way through the problems that it's encountered in this part of the political thicket. And I want to just sort of flesh out a little bit why I think that's so. And this picks up on one of the comments that Pam made at the very end. So I think there are two things going on right now. There's a hydraulics issue, a push for judicial intervention that maintains its power despite years and years of writing and worries about it. But I think what is different is that every path is open for the water to flow. And so let me just sort of flesh out what I mean by that. I've stunned sort of by the power of the judicial impulse to act and why it remains as powerful as it is. So we do see on occasion judges calling for withdrawal, most notably the four justices in Veith. But nonetheless, we see this every time they get a decision, they try to do something. I mean, whether it's just sort of the sort of pragmatic Breyer impulse, I'm a smart guy, I can fix this problem, or some sort of sense of duty, or some sort of sense that no one else is going to fix this problem, whatever it is that those forces remain strong with this court, and it is not a court that is known for its judicial modesty anyway. So it remains interested in getting involved in the political fray, or it has the duties forced upon it, as it would have you think after Bush versus Gore. But nonetheless, the court remains ready to intervene in the political process in lots of different ways. And they are undeterred, in a remarkable way, by failure and public humiliation. So it's actually like it's like a Greek myth or like an Indiana Jones movie. You know, when Indiana Jones is captured by the bad guy and the henchmen are sent in to do, you know, into the cave. And one goes in, out comes his head rolls out. And then another henchman is sent in, and his head rolls out. And then Indiana Jones, of course, is going to go in and find the treasure. I don't know who the Indiana Jones is on the court, but I will just say we've seen a lot of head whacking take place. So just think about it. After the humiliation of Shaw, the Supreme Court was widely considered to be a laughingstock among the Academy for Shaw, except by one or two academics. The Shaw jurisprudence actually led to amicus briefs filed by major civil rights organizations, which basically said Justice O'Connor is a racist. And they kept filing that brief over and over throughout the 90s. Justice O'Connor is a racist. Justice O'Connor is a racist. Now, it's not really a great strategy for winning your case. But the fact that they felt that so deeply, you know, might have been thought of as a signal to the court that something was going on here. And we even saw the court retreat from Shaw. So we all thought, after Justice Breyer's last opinion, the court has pulled out of Shaw. It's not going to be doing this anymore. And yet, nonetheless, we see, as Rick Pildes and Guy Charles have pointed out, the court pulling Shaw principles into its interpretation of the Voting Rights Act in the most recent decision. After the humiliation of Veith. So here's a case where the court splits 4-1-4, where it's widely mocked for the fact that four justices think that it's non-justiciable, four justices say it's justiciable, but we can't agree as to how to decide it. And then Justice Kennedy writes an opinion that Justice Scalia says, you know, rather sharply, is lawless. We have this sort of opinion, and yet we see the court's utterly unable to deal with a partisan gerrymandering question. It has no answer as a body to this question. And yet we see, as Guy Charles and Alan Katz point out, political gerrymandering questions coming into the Voting Rights Act, so they're pulling in those interests there. After the humiliation of campaign finance, the crack cocaine distinction in Buckley versus Vallejo, we see Scalia and Thomas repackaging, as Pam points out, free speech as an associational interest. We see Justice Souter expanding, again, as Pam points out, the corruption rationale from a quid pro quo approach to a hostile environment standard. We see Justice Breyer repackaging his technocratic impulses in the sort of kumbaya version of a participatory democracy. But in any case, what we see over and over again is, despite what would widely considered to be utter failures in intervention, the court keeps moving in, and it keeps bringing in the same ideas and just putting them in a different form. And so I wonder sort of to myself, as I was sitting and listening to the comments this morning, why it is that we have this powerful hydraulic impulse for judicial reform. Water seeks its own level. Now, the unsophisticated version of a hydraulics argument is simply just to say that. But the more sophisticated version of a hydraulics argument is usually to say something about, well, where does water go? It matters which outlet the judicial impulse finds. And so, in lots of ways, you would think that the impulse behind what we should be doing now is to think about which outlet is the court going to pursue and how will that shape our democracy, because it will matter whether they pick a rights or a structure approach. It will matter whether or not they go through the Voting Rights Act to police these questions or through some other strategy. But I've actually come to sort of think that, in fact, every avenue is open. The court has virtually every tool in the toolbox, and there's no stronger or weaker place for the water to grow. The dam is just exploding everywhere, to continue a rather bad metaphor. And so this is why we see hundreds of pages of opinions every time the court issues a decision. This is why we see them putting these bizarre mergers of the Voting Rights Act and Shaw versus Reno, partisan gerrymandering, the Voting Rights Act. You know, there's sort of these creatures. It's like a creature double feature movie. You know, Godzilla marries King Kong, and look at the creature that's produced from it. But these new doctrines are not any better than the old doctrines. All we have is a sort of sense of almost randomness about what are they going to say? How are they going to come out with it? And I just think that Veith, if you read the briefs in Veith, I mean, everyone put everything they had in front of the court. I mean, there were all sorts of good amicus briefs in there. There were all sorts of paths available to the court. It just, it was utterly unpredictable as to which one they would take and why. So the court continues to flounder around, and they now have a set of doctrinal tools that is either so loose and flabby that they can do virtually anything they want, or if they can't, they just merge the doctrines together and get to the place that they want to go. And so what happens in a context like this when you have both the sort of hydraulic push to reform, but nothing cabining or focusing where the water emerges? And I think that, you know, there are a couple things we might see. The first is convergence. That is, we might see something like Justice Stevens's, you know, unitary theory of voting that's going to work for partisan gerrymandering and racial discrimination and so on. That is, we might see them eventually pushing their way into sort of a single standard. So it may be Stevens's sort of unitary approach. It may be intent, which is always the last refuge of a doubting justice. Intent is a very comfortable place for the justices to be, because then they can say, well, we're not making judgments about sort of how politics ought to be structured. We're just identifying the bad people. And so they're the bad people with a bad partisan impulse, or the bad people with a racially discriminatory impulse. So it's a very, it's the kind of thing that judges do. So intent seems like a pretty obvious grounds for convergence going forward. Or we might sort of just continue to see the court muddling through. That would be my guess, actually, for at least a while, that they're going to continue to sort of feel the way around and try to find some way to work through these problems. And they're basically going to wait until a coherent majority emerges on one side or another of this court. And so... And this is a place, I know Rick isn't here to present his paper. This is a place where I'm the place where I part company with Rick's analysis is simply in the confidence with which he expresses it. So I would not be willing to make many conclusions at all about where the court is going from this set of opinions for two reasons. One, every opinion garners one or two justices at best. And two, the opinions so clearly read like the justices who wrote them. I mean, you don't have to actually know who wrote it. When you read Randell, it's got Justice Breyer written all over it. It's, there's a problem, and I have five approaches to the problem, and I've dug through my law clerk dug through the political science literature, and I read a little bit of it, and here it is. You know, it's sort of a technocrat's fix. And when you read, when you read LULAC, it's Justice Kennedy. You can hear the national anthem in the background. Broad, beautiful principles, race, something, group, but, you know, who knows what it means? There's no traction here that's coming from the doctrine. It's simply sort of the personal intuitions and impulses of the justices writ large, and this is a context in which the justices are more likely to go along with that because no one else has a much better idea. They want to decide these cases, and particularly in the first year of the Roberts Court, I think they're likely to be gentler with one another. That is, they're going to be more willing to go along with the sort of idiosyncratic views of the majority of the justice writing the opinion, simply so that because they're already so badly fractured now, I think they're willing to give a little bit. So the question, though, for us is, well, where do we go from here? And I mean us as in academics and people who practice. You know, the sort of question is, how in the world do you sit and analyze a court that is this messy? And there seem to be a couple things you can do. One is to take the Brandeis approach. And by that I meant, you know, Brandeis is said to be the master of the telescope and the microscope. And so there are two things that seem to be able to sort of either give you some predictive sense of where the court is going or maybe even to sort of convince them to go someplace. The telescope is simply getting a sense of their sort of impulses, almost like a psychoanalytic account of the justices' views. So Rick Pildes' paper a while back after Bush v. Gore about stability and the court's sense and need for stability, I think, got it just about right for mapping some of the justices' intuitions. Linda Greenhouse's comment about when she pulled together Pam and Ellen's paper saying that it relates to claims about political entitlement, I think that also gets it just about right. It sort of explains a strong intuition that sort of you can see filtering through these cases, whether or not it'll give you a prediction as to where the doctrine will bring you, it might help you figure out where they're going to go. The other possibility is the microscope. I mean, that is simply the value with you know, the Brandeis brief, telling a good story. So, you know, when you read Justice Kennedy's opinion, it's clear that he was captured by the story of Bonilla's district. It was a powerful story, and he got it. And so the telescope and microscope seem to be two tools that would be useful for academics and practitioners for the next few years. A second sort of move I think we're going to see is the sort of institutional turn in legal scholarship. And we see it in lots of different ways, calls for nonpartisan districting or bureaucrats to district, Michael Kang's work on popular input into districting questions. Work like mine and Sam Zakros that focuses on sort of administrative law approaches to thinking about policing voting rights questions. It may be that sort of it's time to move a little bit away from the court, move our focus from the court, and to think about other strategies for regulation in a much more serious way than we as a group have done. And finally, there's the approach that Ellen Katz took in her paper, which I thought was one of the standout papers of the conference, which is actually to sort of, it may just be you have to be as good as Ellen is doing this, but to actually be smart enough to find a way to hold their hand and walk them through it. So this is what a bunch of folks in this room did during the period of Shaw, and they almost got the court to a coherent argument. It may be, this is the work, if Sam is right, that the court is going to police using an antitrust metaphor, this is the kind of work that actually the newest member of our group, David Schleicher, has been doing. So, the court is not going to, I think, take the approach that Sam and Rick have so long been advocating unless it can be put into judicially manageable standards. And we are not there yet, as I think is quite evident from Justice Breyer's opinion. And so it may be that some thought as to how to provide judicially manageable standards for the courts to wrap its hand around might be a useful exercise on our part. So I'm not terribly confident. Am I within my time?
Oh, you're fine.
I'm not terribly confident, actually, about where this all should go, and I find myself in a rather pessimistic mood about it generally, in part because nothing bothers more than incoherence. But nonetheless, I think that we should expect this for at least a while. I think we continue to be in the doctrinal interregnum, and it's going to be a little while before it shapes itself into anything that we can wrap our hands around.
Thank you very much.
I guess the first thing I want to do, sort of reaching the end of our day or the end of the symposium, is just thank Ned and Dan and Donald Tobin and Matt Byrne and all the people at the Ohio State Law Journal for your great work in putting this together, because I think it was really well run and I appreciate it being here, and I think we've had really good discussions. So I wanted to get a chance to do that before we closed. Thinking back now on at the beginning of the symposium, or at least when I sort of arrived, which was lunch yesterday, I remember Rick Pildes' question to Linda Greenhouse, or his observation that the media tends to overblow kind of where the court's going and kind of hype up the importance of decisions. And my immediate thought there was it would be kind of hard to do that this year, because for all the reasons that Heather sort of cites, the court is in a kind of holding pattern where it's really difficult to see where they're going, and I think it's really too early to tell. And when I was sort of preparing for the symposium and thinking about doing a roundtable with Heather and Rick and Linda Greenhouse originally, I was thinking we would be talking about where we thought the court would be going and basically having no idea what I was going to say. After Sorrell and Lulac, as we've kind of discussed pretty thoroughly, it's hard to tell really what's going on, particularly given that I think Roberts and Alito have been rather reticent and cautious and maybe are sort of still feeling their way, although we have some intriguing signs. And I think two of the things that I'll take away from the symposium are all these intriguing interpretations that we've sort of spun out and where the court might be going. And I think the most interesting strand for me was the LULAC and the VRA issues, and in particular Rick's piece and Ellen Katz's piece discussed during the last 2 days. Since Rick's not here, I'll spend less time talking about that, in part, I think, because Heather's talked a little bit about it, but also because it's less fun with Rick not being here. So I'll focus more on Ellen Katz's paper, but I think Rick's paper and Ellen's are similar in the sense that both of them potentially read the court as making kind of early but potentially path-breaking steps. They're sort of early signs of interesting doctrinal directions where they could go in defining what constitutes a real political community, or what the meaning of the kind of underlying substantive representational guarantees are. And I think that's very interesting. And the idea that the court appears here to be moving beyond a simple fixation on race or voting preference to something deeper than that, which I think is really interesting. So what I think I want to do here is talk a little bit about Ellen Katz's paper. I'm not so much interpreting her paper, but using that as a starting point, kind of taking her football and running my own plays, kind of taking it and going in a different direction. But I think at base, Ellen is sort of presenting this tension between the VRA and political competition, that's sort of the tension between recognition of race and competitive or vibrant politics, and seeing a little bit of a conflict there that the court has some concern about and wants to address. And I guess I want to question that tension a little bit, and to do so sort of requires a few steps. But I think what's cool is we're moving past bare kind of partisan affiliation and looking for kind of a deeper notion about what politics is about, a deeper sensibility about what substantive politics we want and we want to encourage and the values that are underlying. And I'm going to use kind of a highfalutin word, I guess, or makeup word, really, a democratic contestation, just so that I have a term that I can use. And I think this, to me, is an important value that we'd want to encourage, and I think sort of relates to what Ellen was talking about, maybe what Ellen sees Justice Kennedy talking about. And the idea would be that we want to provide incentives for political leaders really to present the public, present voters, present citizens with meaningful choices about what they want from government and the way that they think about politics. We want them to really consider their alternate political identities that might be politically relevant and make these real choices. And when I say offer, I really mean force. Right? The idea is that political leaders really kind of push upon the voting public real substantive decisions about the way they think about democracy and the way they think about themselves as citizens and voters. And that really pushes well beyond Democrat or Republican, because really what being a Democrat or Republican is sort of a contested thing. And so what I want to say is we want to talk about this debate that plays itself out maybe within the institutional structures of a party, but really is much, much deeper than simple party labels. And I think that's sort of where Ellen Katz's paper sort of takes us in a really cool way. And I think generally that this sort of democratic contestation is a really good thing, right? We think that's healthy, makes people think about politics, it's constitutive, and it has all different types of positive outcomes that we associate with democracy. How does this connect to race? I think maybe the problem is that race, at least under conditions of polarized voting, race kills this type of democratic contestation in the sense that where you have racially polarized voting, everything sort of reduces down to a race, and that kind of kills the debate. It silences the debate. It stops this kind of constant interplay of people thinking about themselves as pro-choice voters, pro-life voters, pro-taxes, pro-guns. It stops that sort of constant debate and attempts by leaders to recharacterize what's important in politics. And so to the degree that race is doing that and sort of stopping the conversation, that's really bad. And I think what's interesting about the voting rights solution to that is by being race conscious, you're sort of liberating politics to talk about other things. And so you're sort of, the VRA is an intervention to address the problem of this impoverished politics, this lack of democratic contestation that is just not challenging and may be only addressed by sort of recognizing and creating these kinds of representational guarantees on the basis of race so that you can talk about other things. So what does this mean for LULAC? Well, if Ellen is right, or I'm right, or my spin on Ellen is right, about where the court might be going, about Kennedy's motivations, about Kennedy's concerns, or even if we think that this idea of democratic contestation is an important value in democracy, this idea of cultural compactness that Rick sort of talks about, that maybe Kennedy is trying to impose on the Voting Rights Act, this idea that what we want to do is kind of protect politically cohesive communities beyond race, beyond party, that's a really bad thing. Because if we do that, we're gonna reduce democratic contestation. By creating kind of politically cohesive, culturally cohesive communities, you don't have that sort of opportunity to debate these important issues. You don't have the types of cleavage and the diversity that would be good, that would be healthy and promote this type of democratic contestation that I'm sort of arguing is good. So in some sense, you need race consciousness or voting cohesiveness to the degree that you need it to address the particular problem of race. But on the other hand, non-racial diversity in redistricting is a really good thing. That the district, the 25th district, the one that stretches from Austin to basically Mexico, that's a really interesting district. That we're going to have an interesting conversation about what voters there want and how they align. And that's a good thing. So to the degree that Justice Kennedy thinks that cultural non-compactness in the 25th district is a bad thing because it's sort of contrary to some deeper notion about democracy and the underlying values, I would argue that that's probably wrong, that we like districts like that because that's where you're going to have the most interesting debate. And the districts where you have real kind of cultural compactness, that those are going to be the least interesting districts. Those are the districts where everyone sort of agrees on too many things, and you're not going to have the kind of confrontation with important political issues and conflicting political identities that I would like to see. So I think I'll stop there and then move on to Dan.
That's great. Well, I'm going to stand up and again do a PowerPoint presentation. Heather was giving me a bit of a hard time on this. I'm not as good a teacher as you. I need the bells and whistles. My title I'll explain in a moment. What I'm going to talk about is a bit on the LULAC opinion and springboarding from some of the things that Rapilda's has said to move back to some of the things that Ned started us off with yesterday morning, thinking about the implications of the Voting Rights Act for issues of election administration. What I have called elsewhere the new vote denial. I'll talk about things like Texas as well as battles that are currently waging in various states. For those of you who can't, it says Georgia voter ID card. Georgia has been the state as much as any other that's been a focal point for these battles over the new vote denial. I'll be focusing mainly not so much on the Supreme Court, but on what's going on and what's been going on in the lower courts. But a bit about the title. Right after the LULAC decision came out, there was this exchange of emails among Heather and Rick Pildes and various other people having to do with the LULAC case and what it meant. And a phrase that Rick Pildes used in one of his emails was hearing the music behind the court's decision. So I started to wonder, boy, I wonder exactly what that music would be and who might be playing it. Rick had this idea, which Michael alluded to a few moments ago, of cultural compactness, new compactness test that the court uses with respect to District 25 in Texas, where we care not only about geographic compactness, but also compactness or similarities in terms of interests and attitudes. So I figured that he might actually be playing the music was Jimmy Buffett, right? Changes in attitudes, changes in latitudes, the new compactness test, or maybe it's, you know, Justice Kennedy as Jimmy Buffett. And immediately afterwards, I got various responses which revealed a lot about the personalities of the people who were in this room. I got emails from Mike Pitts, and I think my colleague Steve Putner said, it's great, I emailed this changes in attitude line out there, thinking, you know, this was going to be my great attempt to come up with a title that was almost worthy of Pam Carlin. And then I got these quizzical emails from Dan Lowenstein and Rick Pildes. What the hell are you talking about? And, you know, a lack of familiarity with Jimmy Buffett music would be the only thing that Dan Lowenstein and Rick Pildes have in common. Let me talk briefly about the new compactness text. I don't really have a whole lot to say here, but what I would like to do, we've been talking at this table, I think, mostly to each other. I'm going to try to talk a little bit more to the people on the outside who may not be as steeped in this stuff as all of us, and try to organize some of the values that are behind this, and then applying this to what I call denial cases, and time permitting, not exasperation with the court in several of the presentations that have been made. And I confess to, at times, sharing this sense of exasperation, maybe not quite as much as others of you who have been working at this for longer than I have and know this stuff much better. I guess, at the same time, I also feel a considerable sense of sympathy for the court, because, especially in the redistricting area, I don't know campaign finance, but especially in the redistricting area, what makes this hard is that we've got multiple competing values, which the court hasn't sorted out, and which the individual justices, as Pam points out, haven't sorted out within their own minds. This is hard stuff, and this is reflected, I think, in some of the comments that I've been getting also from the students who have been listening in to some of these presentations, having a little trouble at times following exactly what's going on. You know, this is really difficult stuff, and I think that in the Lubach case, just to try to wrap this up into something that's understandable, we have four different values going on, or at play, at least four different values, probably come up with more, that are represented by four different lines of cases. And in each of these cases, you see the court initially stating a pretty broad principle, but refining it, cutting back on it later. So in one of those values is minority protection, that's represented by the Voting Rights Act in the Jingles case, another race blindness, the Shaw case, anti-entrenchment, Davis versus Vandermeer, and state sovereignty, the Burley-Lyon case. I think the first three are certainly at the fore of the Lubach case. I think the fourth one is in the background of the Lubach case, although the court really isn't expressing the talk about it. So we've got Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act requiring under Jingles majority-minority districts where there's a compact population and racial bloc voting. Section 5 clearance requirement, which has historically been used to force the creation of majority-minority districts. But then we have the court cutting back on that value, I would say, through cases such as Georgia versus Ashcroft, which I use as representative of other cases, like Reno versus Bossier, where the court has limited the Justice Department's ability to force the creation of majority-minority districts. Second value, race blindness. We have Shaw versus Reno decided in 1993, and the cases that follow saying that the use of race is subject to strict scrutiny, where race is the predominant factor. But again, the court cutting back, or the Stephen cut back in their case, most notably Easley, saying that, well, it's okay if politics, not race, is the predominant factor. The third value, anti-entrenchment. Davis versus Vandermeer saying these claims of partisan gerrymandering are justiciable, but that getting plaintiffs in these kinds of cases basically nowhere up to and including through the Beef decision, which leaves us without a standard. And finally, state sovereignty. In the background, I would say in blue lack, and will be in the foreground of cases challenging the new Voting Rights Act, requiring the civil rights statutes be congruent and proportional to remedying constitutional violations as defined by the Supreme Court. Although Lane and Gibbs, I would say, pushing back on this principle a little bit and suggesting that Congress ought to have more latitude when we're dealing with fundamental rights or suspect classifications, both of which are implicated by the Voting Rights Act. So to map this out, I'm a visual person, so this is sort of the way I imagine things. We've got these four different norms. Minority protection going from Jingles to Georgia versus Ashcroft, and again, in each of these areas, the court articulating the principle and then refining it or cutting back on it. Race blindness going from Shaw to Easley. Anti-entrenchment, Vandermeer to Veith. And then state sovereignty, Bernie to Tennessee versus Lane. And, you know, I put the Lubach case, before we get to this, so we've got this tension between the top two values, which come to the fore in the Shaw line of cases, between There it goes. One of the things that I think has come up in several of the presentations today is that although the court is technically relying on a minority protection rationale, there's a lot of anti-entrenchment ideas going on in the court, and I think this is accurate, is using the Voting Rights Act as a vehicle for at least trying to serve its value to some extent, even though it can't come up with a workable constitutional test for anti-entrenchment. Another observation I think, and made in the Weekly Comment that appeared on our website a few moments ago, was that I think that in a sense you can see, and maybe this is just a different way of stating what I just said, you can see the court through its interpretation of the statute, the Voting Rights Act, pursuing what we ordinarily think of as constitutional values. We said that, see that in New Latin, this may seem like a bit of a stretch, it probably is. We also see that in another decision, probably the most important decision to come out this past term, the Honda decision, which has democratic values, I suggest, written all over it, and is also technically a statutory interpretation case, but again, one with constitutional values written all over. I want to now turn this towards considering an area of law that has not been, well, I'm not actually going to skip through the pictures of Texas. An area of law that's received a lot less attention as a matter of Voting Rights Act jurisprudence, what I call the new vote denial cases, best represented by the identification laws passed in Georgia and other states. We've also seen litigation under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act with respect to felony disenfranchisement laws and voting machines in the past few years. And what's remarkable to me on most of the previous cases is that the courts don't really seem to have much of an idea at all as to what tests ought to apply under Section 2 to these kinds of cases. In effect, well, let me list the various cases we've seen here. I'm just going to go through this. Georgia is probably the case that the state has received the most attention. Federal and state courts have issued injunctions against the state's ID requirements. In Indiana, a federal court has upheld that state's vote ID requirements. An injunction was issued in Missouri, and but in Arizona, a federal court upheld a non-photo ID requirement. Finally, most recently, last week, the House passed a photo ID bill just last week, House Bill 4844. Voting rights groups are concerned that these laws are going to have a disparate impact on certain groups of voters, including minorities, because those groups are less likely to have ID. And there's some evidence to support that proposition, although there's not a whole lot of empirical evidence either way on it. There was a study in Wisconsin finding that in that state, only 22% of black males 18 to 24 years old actually have a state-issued driver's license. And so there was concern that these laws are going to have a disparate impact on people of color and other groups like people with disabilities and elderly voters. As I mentioned, the courts really don't seem to have come up with a workable standard for dealing with these claims. And what's remarkable to me is that although a claim was stated in the Georgia case under Section 2, in a lot of these other cases, we don't even see Section 2 claims being made. Now, this may have a lot to do, probably does have a lot to do with the lack of empirical evidence. I think it also has to do with the fact that we don't have a workable standard for adjudicating these claims. And I guess what I want to suggest is that, and I'm going to close with this point and leave the constitutional issues aside, because I think I've talked enough. What's going on here is a bit similar to what was going on in just representation. And one that draws on at least one of the features of Lublack, despite the justifiable criticisms of it which have been made during the past 2 days, I think it's worth recommending, and that is using the interpretation of the Voting Rights Act to affirm and support and promote values that we ordinarily associate with the Constitution.
Great.
Heather,
Michael, do you want to? Okay.
Two quick comments. One stems from a paper Sam that I was reading a while back. And it goes to the question of where Heather started, you know, why is it that everything is up for grabs? I guess struggling with that the last couple of days, and one of the things that comes to mind is that it seems that it's not just on the court where everything is up for grabs, but also in other parts of our democracy, right? In Congress and in the states, and Dan brings this out of the voter ID debate. And the question is, it seems to me the way to begin thinking about this is, what do you do in a mature democracy where there is an intense pressure to have a perfect democratic process, right? And a lot of ways to start thinking about the issues in democracy, such as how much competition we want to have, how perfect do we, how much we want to eliminate voter fraud, how easy do we want to make it for people to vote, right? I think these are the next generation of issues that a mature democracy begins to grapple with, and in ways that we as a society, not just the courts, particularly the courts, but we as a society have not fundamentally grappled with, or we haven't taken those seriously. Sort of emerged into the process that we find ourselves. And so now we're beginning to think about those issues and beginning to think about them at a serious level, and we're not, you know, we're not sure. And so it's not just on the courts, right, where you see, I think it's most evident, of course, where you see the court being at sea, but also when you look across other institutional domains as we're grappling with issues in a mature democracy that we haven't grappled with, you also see a bit of misdirection or indecision or conflicting values in those domains. And to some extent, there's both hope and despair to some extent. And race, I think, is a particularly good example, maybe a little obvious where it comes to play. You know, as I argue, when you look at the way that race is being deployed, I don't think there's so much the horror anymore because we're past that. Right? We're not of the view that by being race conscious, things are going to fall apart automatically. Right? But we're also uncomfortable with how much race consciousness that there is in a mature democracy in that process. So I guess one way to begin thinking about this is whether one, this is just symptomatic of the court, and two, this is really not a large problem of dealing with particular pressures of particular issues in pressure problems. One last quick comment on compactness, as Dan put up the map of Texas, I said to Sam, tell me, and I really do, I mean, I'm patient, which means I'm slow on the uptake, but if you explain to me, I'll get there. How is District 23 more compact than anything else? So if anybody will explain that to me very slowly, I would be truly appreciative.
I'm not going to explain it. I'll just put up the map. So there's a, for those of you, we've been talking about these districts the whole time, and that might be helpful to have that. I'm pretty sure this is the 2003 version. But here's, so I've superimposed this on map of Texas. Here's 25, the one that they said was, you know, united this two distinct Latino communities, one up here, Austin, one down here by the border, and here's
The easy explanation in some sense is there's a tension between geographical districting and one person, one vote that requires, you know, if you had a GIS here where you could impose the actual populations on these districts, this district, most of this area here doesn't have any people.
There's
every other. Well, it has people, but they're all people crossing from here. This is to tie in with, you know, you're pointing to all of these tensions, and then back to Dan's. There's this tension that every piece of earth has to be in a district, but what we really care about is not the pieces of earth, it's the people.
So I just want to respond to the first piece. I agree most of the way, although I'm not sure if I would call this a mature democracy so much as a sort of democracy in a midlife crisis buying a Porsche and you know, getting hair extensions or something. I mean, I actually don't think this is a mature democracy. And I think, in fact, that's sort of the source of the problem. So the thing that we lack that most mature democracies have is a nonpartisan system for administering districts. You know, this is sort of Sam's. So for channeling competition in ways that are healthier than the ones we have now. And so many. I always embarrassed to say such things. I wouldn't say it. So many of our competitive impulses are pushed towards restructuring and rejiggering the system. I think that's exactly the kind of hydraulic push, not necessarily sort of getting closer to perfection, so much as creating more and more imperfections in an already imperfect democracy. But I agree with you that that does lead to the problems that the court and everyone else has encountered, because the sort of doctrinal tools we have are just not that fine-grained for dealing with these increasingly creative. It's almost like a Section 5 problem, you know, that it's just hard to keep up with the increasingly creative ways that partisans have figured out for protecting themselves.
One very quick sentence on the compactness point, which I think follows on what Dan was saying. Again, whether you buy it or not, I think Kennedy's notion is entitlement and status quo ante. In other words, it's not that 23 is more compact than 25, it just got there first. And it has this pre-existing right just by virtue of existing that can't be taken away, whereas 25 it's the late comer and new, and so it has a different status under the Voting Rights Act because it's new, not old.
I mean, I think there's a little more to it than that, and I think this is actually implicit in something you wrote shortly after the opinion came out, Ned, which is, you know, there is maybe something to this cultural similarity of most of the people in District 23 that doesn't exist with respect to District 25 that at least arguably, I don't know how factually true this is, includes two very different Latino communities.
The dangers of blogging.
No, I mean, I want to open it up to, I saw Sam's hand. The mic or speak up one of the listeners.
We were pretty much picking up on an argument that was been put forward by Schumpeter and some others on democracy's accountability. And there's a certain crudeness to that argument, but I think that it captures a central insight about democratic legitimacy, which is it is the consent of the governed in some fashion, and the fact that you have to go before them in some periodic sense is what defines democracies. The fact that you have not a first election but a second election is what differentiates a democracy from a plebiscitary tyrannical regime. The problem we ran into is the problem that Heather and others have put forward of, do you really want to discount all participatory values in democracy? And so Heather looks to these citizens groupings, or there's other ways that we can structure participatory theories. And I've been skeptical of these participatory theories. But what both Ellen yesterday and Michael in a more formal way with this theory of democratic contestation put forward is the idea that you can actually put those two pieces together quite effectively, the accountability and the participation, by talking about effective participation and not, you know, town hall meetings that don't resolve anything or faculty meetings that resolve less than nothing or things of that sort, but rather putting people in a situation where their participation can actually make a difference in a meaningful sense, and that's largely tied into the accountability point. In a new work of mine that Guy was referring to that has to do not with the United States almost at all, but with other countries with much more fragile or unstable democratic regimes, I'm trying to move toward the idea that what democracy is really about is the renewability of consent and the non-permanence of the decisions that are made by government. And those two features, I think, are nicely picked up in this term, Michael, that you're putting forward about democratic contestation. Now I want to just finish by saying there's one third point out there that you're not addressing, and I thought that Ellen was going at more forthrightly yesterday, and that is the piece about representation. Because we also have another plane where this argument goes forward. Sometimes in the narrow race area in the United States, we describe it as the difference between descriptive and substantive representation. But it is the tension that if you really want to have democratic contestation as you put forward, everything's got to be up for grabs. And that means we got to be willing to come out one year with an all-white legislature or an all-black legislature. You know, it could be all sorts of weird permutations that we have to have such faith in the process integrity that we're willing to live with the year-to-year permutations that might take a form that we can't anticipate ahead of time. And I thought that Ellen was quite bold in pushing the envelope on this thing and saying, let's put that on the table directly. You go down the path of this democratic contestation, you got to realize that's where you're heading also.
Right. I think that's right. Although I think of race, at least in the polarized voting context, is a little different because it's sort of contrary to the value of contestation that I'm thinking about. So I don't know if I'd go quite that far to say an all-white legislature under all conditions, right? Not everything's up for grabs. I would sort of bracket that one issue maybe as a little bit different. But I think that's right. I mean, I think that is certainly the risk of any sort of competition approach. Because another way of thinking about this, I deliberately didn't say competition. I said contestation, which is pretty similar, but it's a sort of different form of competitiveness or competition than is usually kind of put forward, which is usually at the kind of the party level or the candidate level. And I guess what I would like to do is kind of push a little bit deeper than that. And I think I'd have to think about the representational guarantees and representational values a little bit more and see if I want to sort of cut back on that, but I don't think I do. And the reason is that Pam made the distinction between sort of top-down or bottom-up. I'm not sure if there's really bottom-up. To me, a lot of politics, or almost all politics, is driven top-down. It's leadership incentives to create certain cleavages, present choices, and people divide along those lines.
That's Schumpeter. I mean, you're very much in that tradition.
Absolutely. And so I worry about a representational guarantee, again, bracketing race, based on anything else. I don't know that we need, you know, a pro-life district or something like that. That sort of strikes me as totally off. And even sort of more broadly, and maybe that's a ridiculous example, even more generally,
I don't know that we need a liberal district. I mean, if we have sort of this a bold attempt to create this type of contestation across a whole jurisdiction, that will play itself out in a way that I think is probably going to be pretty sensible and will provide some sort of representation, assuming that these different different values have enough support in the population and the leaders are reasonably competent. That's always sort of a risky assumption. But that that should sort of work its way out in a pretty good way. But I wouldn't want to carve out, right? And I don't think we generally do in law or in democracy, carve out representational guarantees outside of race.
I saw Richard's hand earlier, and now I see Pam. If anybody else would like to...
Pam is on this. I would let her go first because my comments are really
late. It's a one-sentence question for Michael, which is, under your theory of democratic contestation, what's either the purpose or the principle by which districts are drawn? What should the composition of a district look like?
So I think...
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, the question is, under a theory in which you want everything to be up for grabs in districts in this kind of contestation way, what's the theory by which the conscientious district drawer, if you were drawing the districts in Texas, would you use geographic districts? If so, why would you use them and how would you decide where to draw the lines?
That's a good question. I think my comments today were directed as a response to what I saw as Kennedy kind of trying to create homogeneous districts. And so what I would say is I don't think that's a good idea. I think what you're asking me is for a sort of a more elaborated, affirmative account of what it would look like. And I think that's harder. I mean, I think that's sort of the challenge for the competition advocates is what does that mean practically? Operationally, how do you go about the methodology? I think that's harder. But I think what I articulated today was try to give you a broad sense of the theory on which any kind of operationalization is going to be grounded, right? And so I think that's sort of the next step is to, if we were deciding that that's the affirmative theory for redistricting that we want to build on, this is where we start.
So I know Richard wants to take us off on a little different direction, but I have a
question to ask later.
So okay. I saw John.
A different direction.
David,
kind of look directly in. I'm not exactly sure that the taking the road of democratic contestation needs to go everywhere. I think that part of the problem is that there are internal inconsistencies in the idea of political competition, that kind of starting with the beginning of the political science work on this, there was a neat relation between what Schumpeter thought and what kind of representation idea. And there were, when you go back and look at the Schumpeter, it's not there. That Schumpeter, I wrote news for a democratic theorist, cares very little about the demos. That he doesn't care about representation at all. There's a separate value for competition, which is that it produces stable outcomes and it provides clear winners that have some degree of legitimacy. And so, because there are ideas in competition that are conflicting, there are compromises even inside a contestation model or a competition model. And so, there's an idea you can take which you want to maximize to a point, some idea of constrained maximization, which is where I think the race idea kind of coming out is perfectly fine, because there seems to be the idea that you're in maximizing competition, you can maximize several values, not just one. And so sometimes the Supreme Court, in the Timmons case, they say, we're in favor of competition, we're in favor of a certain idea of competition, but there are balances against it. And so, I don't know that we definitely have to assume that competition means one thing and that we have to break down that divide and just say, there are compromises to be made even inside the idea of competition or contestation.
I have 2 points. One relates actually primarily to Ned's talk at the beginning of this and a little bit about Michael's. This is about sort of it gets us down at least one level, possibly two, into sort of doctrine and back to the justices. I guess I disagree with Ned's way of framing that there are sort of these discrete and coherent groups on the court, because this really relates to something in Pam's paper. What strikes me is of the two biggest groupings on the court, how incoherent they are if we try and hold the two big areas that have dominated our discussion over these 2 days together, which is gerrymandering and campaign finance reform. What is amazingly striking, if you look at the Scalia-Thomas group, is its total deference to politics in the context of gerrymandering and total rejection of the output of the political process and campaign finance regulation. Great concern about incumbent protection and entrenchment in campaign finance law, no concern about it in gerrymandering. And then if you flip over to the other half, the other side of the court, which you didn't mention in your groupings, the Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg group, it's the exact opposite. Stevens, Souter, and Ginsburg are very deferential to the political process when they write campaign finance laws and very committed to overseeing it, if not overturning the political process when it gerrymanders. So actually what's striking, and it's Pam's paper, you know, don't fully develop it, but obviously you're talking about it, and so I think we have this deep incoherence. The only two who are out of the, let's call it the continuing court, because the new court hasn't really spoken of the continuing court, there's a certain amount of coherence to both Breyer and Kennedy. They are the only ones that are actually willing to review but not reject, or accept but not accept everything that the political process produces. So Kennedy wants to review gerrymandering. He doesn't know how. He's very skeptical about campaign finance regulation, but he doesn't reject them outright. Breyer wants to review gerrymandering, but only in a limited set of situations. He had the narrowest of all the tests that were put forward in Veith. Is willing to uphold campaign finance law, but with some review with bite, as he does in Randall. And indeed, you could separate the two of them. Kennedy looks more, if we want to use our structure rights debate, Kennedy looks like rights. He's very concerned about the First Amendment rights of donors and the First Amendment rights of speakers. And he seems to be, and his concern in gerrymandering is the sort of the fact that majority, that the groups don't get their fair share, that the reason that the Democrats lose in Texas is because they got fair representation as a group of individuals. He's not concerned about the structural, the competition issue. He's concerned with the seats-votes relationship. And Breyer is actually adopts the structural model. He's worried in both cases about the impact on competition of entrenchment. So there is... Breyer is himself relatively coherent. Kennedy is relatively coherent in this very vague way. The two are sort of the middle on that. But what strikes me is how the other five in groups of three and two are wildly incoherent in their inability to hold together these two areas of law. And so I don't know, that's sort of maybe consistent with Heather's sort of hydraulics everywhere, and it's all Katrina. We're just covered in water. But it's just sort of, it strikes me, and to me it's the great... I don't know whether it's partisan explanations or what. It's the great paradox of this area is how they don't see it as an area. They see it as two completely discrete, unrelated areas, exception of two of them. If I can make one other comment, it really relates more to Michael. Pam talked about, you know, the contribution expenditure distinction is the most ridiculous, most reviled, most criticized distinction in law except for cocaine, since crack and powder. I actually think, another candidate for that is, of course, the distinction between race and party. I just taught Whitcomb versus Chavez. You know, the Indiana multi-member district, it burdened the blacks, but it was okay because they lost because they were Democrats and not because they were black. From 1971 to 2006, the court has, Sam has written about this, the court has consistently adhered to the race-party distinction. You see it in Whitcomb versus Chavez. It comes up more strongly more recently in Bush versus Vera, Cromartie versus Easley, Georgia versus Ashcroft, and in LULAC. And over and over again, race and party get wildly different treatment. And to me, there's always been two big questions about that. Why, normatively, and how do you tell them apart? And I think Michael begins the process of telling, gives it a reason why. I mean, Scalia has tried to come up with a reason why in Veith, which I thought was very unpersuasive, is that racial discrimination happens rarely, and partisan happens a lot, so it would give us too many cases, and something about maybe the essentialism of race and the differences in party. But I think one thing I found very useful about Michael's comments is to give more of a normative basis for figuring out why. I still can't see how you do it practically. As people were talking about LULAC, it looked to me like, I don't know if it was Ellen or someone else, and Geet wrote about it in his paper too, that it was race being used for party or party being used for race, but that, you know, somebody looked like a race case and somebody looked like a party case. And the answer, of course, is yes. And so I still think it doesn't help us to distinguish, and to me that is the deeper dilemma, I think that contribution expenditure doesn't work very well, but there's a certain way in which it works. You can at least tell what something is most of the time, even if you don't have a good theory as to why you distinguish them. I think what we've got here in terms of this dilemma is not even able to tell what they are most of the time, and yet there's such wild consequences come out of it for doing it. So that's more like a vector coming off of your comment rather than a question. I do have a little question buried in there, or an observation, which is, it's clear you're obviously skeptical of homogeneous districts and in favor of heterogeneous districts because of the way in which they promote the value of democratic contestation. My limited recollection of the literature, of the sort of the Robert Putnam social capital literature, is of course homogeneous districts are much better at eliciting participation and people actually going to meetings and showing up and talking about things because they're comfortable with their fellow citizens. So they're actually comfortable with disagreement in a setting where the disagreements are not huge. Whereas people are much less likely to participate or vote. I mean, there's stuff about school board elections, for example. Much less likely to participate, and really gets to Sam's three different ways of thinking about this. If participation is a value, people actually participate a lot less in heterogeneous areas because they don't like conflict. So I think that's another complication, though I see where you're going.
Homogeneous and heterogeneous on what dimensions?
Well, that's a good question. I don't actually
recall.
Do you
think race here?
Well, I think race is probably a big part of it.
Yeah.
But there might be other factors, too. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, see, I think if the argument is that racial homogeneity increases discussion, that's consistent with what I'm saying.
Yeah, right? It increases the comfort level, I guess,
right.
Which then leads to the discussion.
Right, which opens up the discussion in a way that I think is good.
Yeah.
Right.
Thank you. Sure. I just want to respond briefly. I mean, I agree with the sentiment, and it comes up in both the things that I was talking about here, LULAC and voter ID battles. It's awfully hard to tell whether race or politics is motivating things. And in some ways, I think it's a false distinction because it's both that's going on. I mean, I'm telling you my views about what the Georgia legislature is intending, but I think that they're passing this ID bill because they know it's going to disproportionately disenfranchise blacks. And I think that there is, you know, the court has been unable to come up with a good line for the bottom right value I illustrated here, anti-entrenchment in any context, as far as I can tell. And it's a hard question. But I think a workable line, and one that I would defend normatively, is that this sort of partisan overreaching is especially noxious when you're screwing over a minority group. And I think that's what's happening in Georgia. I think that that is what the court thought was happening in Texas.
Thought briefly in response to the incoherence of the Scalia position. I mean, I'm going to put Stevens aside and the Ginsburg and Souter, only because I don't think they're in play for the control of the court, despite maybe one point that Heather made about Stevens' jurisprudence. I wish Brad Smith were here still, because I think he might be able to defend a Scalia point of view across the range of election law issues in the way that I possibly couldn't do, because I'm not at all sympathetic to it. But I think there would be a comeback to that. I mean, I think there is the obvious point that has been made that Scalia uses the word competition to strike down campaign finance laws, but refuses to acknowledge it in his political question doctrine in the gerrymandering context. And so that's out there. But I think what might be said in defense of that view is, you know, there's a priority of the First Amendment that just has to intercede. It has a libertarian implication for him, and that just comes first. It has a lexical priority, to use that, you know, terminology from Rawls, and you then think about other things afterwards. The real inconsistency, I think, within the Scalia-Thomas position is between the Bush versus Gore line of cases, or one line, and maybe point may become a line, versus the political question doctrine. I think Sam is right. He left, but where Frankfurter is going to come back, Baker versus Carr is going to come back, I think those justices are much more likely to try to stop. I mean, after all, they wrote the Article II position in Bush versus Gore. Scalia has been reputed to say he doesn't think much of the equal protection argument, even though he joined the opinion. Whether that's true or not doesn't really matter, but in the next case, he could articulate a reason why that should be extraordinarily limited. And so I think over time, that group on the court will look more coherent than perhaps it does at the moment, but I don't want to take any more time trying to defend that point of view. I want to recognize John.
I was wondering if I could take Dan back to voter ID. I agree that this is going to be a much bigger issue than we're seeing now. We see four legislatures with major controversial ID laws, but a large number of them ramping up some form of ID requirement. Whether it's photo ID or non-photo, and then you have the citizen, proof of citizenship, which comes in Arizona. This tends to break down traditionally along Republican-Democratic lines, access, integrity. Interestingly, it doesn't seem to bring out the sort of libertarian aspects of people who worry about big government or big brother watching and having a photo ID. That doesn't seem to have come into these debates at all, and maybe it's because we're in a security era. But I guess I just don't see this ID issue. I wonder how we can resolve it either in the middle politically or if the court is willing to draw some lines in the middle here, because I don't think it's as noxious on the part of some who advocate voter ID requirements as maybe you portrayed it. Most people support, at least in public opinion polls, a general sense that we should have some sort of identification of the polls. The Carter Baker Commission, when they came out with their report, was criticized for this heavily, but you know, in truth, I think tried to work off of a lot of other aspects of our policy where we are seeing IDs. We're seeing IDs being required, real ID, and immigration, and even identity theft and medical records, so that there's sort of a call for IDs. We see other countries doing it. I think the Democrats and the Carter Baker Commission had worked in international elections and thought this is a kind of a normal part of elections to have IDs. In developing countries, we have some sort of form, even if it's just putting your finger in an indelible ink. But so I think these are going to keep coming, and wondered whether there is some middle ground between some of the, at least Georgia State decisions I've seen almost seem to say that nothing but swearing an affidavit as a backup is okay. Even non-voter ID is sort of problematic, could drive people away from the polls, might be able to get there, and the sort of more extreme form, which doesn't take into account getting free IDs to people or say a modest non-photo ID. What's the middle ground, and where might the court draw the line, because they think these things are coming?
A couple of responses. First, you're right to say that I do think that these things are quite noxious, not only because of whom they exclude, but because of the almost complete lack of evidence supporting the argument that they're needed. Second, we did have a compromise, and that was called the Help America Vote Act, which required first-time voters who registered by mail to provide some form of documentary ID, something that voters are much more likely to have than the kinds of photo ID that are being required in the states I mentioned earlier. Third, where do I think the court should draw the line? I didn't go into this in detail, but the basic idea would be, at least for purposes of a Section 2 analysis, I think a showing of a disparate impact arising from this practice, a disparate racial impact, ought to be enough to shift the burden to the government of coming up with a pretty strong justification for practices that result in a disproportionate denial of minority votes.
What practices are they? Photo ID or
photo ID
other documentary ID would also fall in that?
Photo ID is an example. Registration practices like those which have been challenged in Ohio and Florida, that is, restrictions on third-party groups engaging in voter registration efforts. I would also suggest database matching protocols that may have a disparate impact on certain groups to the same kind of disparate impact test. Someone can make a prima facie case under Section 2 by showing a disparate impact on a minority group. The burden then ought to shift to the government to come up with a pretty strong justification. I'd suggest something, have suggested something close to a compelling interest scrutiny to justify the practice.
Can I just jump in here? The one thing I wanted to sort of question is whether or not it's really the courts are going to provide the solution to this. So it seems to me that it's great to fight the good fight on these issues, but in the long run, either the immigration issue or the national security issue is just going to wash over this in a way that's going to have – so that these fights on a state-by-state basis aren't going to be what matters. And if I were the Democrats, what I would do is have in my filing cabinet something that push – when this gets pushed through, that also pushes along with it something like same-day registration. That just seems like an easy, straightforward compromise that would give a little bit to both sides. And once you have the kind of national ID that I think is almost inevitable, it's pretty easy to argue for same-day registration.
And I think, if we're going to go there, I think I would agree with something like that, or something like what Rick Hassan has proposed for universal registration. That was his recommendation. Couple national voter ID with something like universal registration. But I'm not done fighting this fight yet, because I'm not ready to consider for laws for which limitations on access to the vote, which no factual predicate has yet been established.
I actually think some of those ideas, Rick's ideas, are very interesting going, but they're out a little bit, and of course even our where you're going is out a few years, but we can easily imagine the case where multiple state legislatures are passing photo ID laws and being struck down, and is the court going to step in the interim? And I don't know. It seems like it'll be a big enough issue that they'll be tempted to do so. I'm not sure that there's some coherence of what they'll do.
As soon as we've got a circuit conflict, I think there's a good chance that they will. And I think
but that should be soon, right? Yeah.
The 7th and 11th circuits in particular, where these issues are percolating, well, you may be able to distinguish the Indiana and Georgia law, but I think it would be seen.
I think it is interesting, as Dan mentioned, I think at the outset, that so far the injunctions are being granted not on Section 2 Voting Rights Act grounds, but on sort of poll tax Harper type grounds. And my instinct on that, you'd think going to the Constitution is a last resort. You do statutory interpretation first, you do Constitution at last resort. But I actually think the constitutional ruling might actually be a narrower ground, funnily enough, in this area, because I think Dan is right that if you sort of map out a quasi-Title VII type disparate impact theory onto the new vote denial as he talks about it, it's fairly easy to think about the notion of a prima facie case when you see a disparate impact. I think John has an instinct that's important that plays out not just with respect to photo ID or even documentary ID, but it could affect even an affidavit requirement if you could actually show that an affidavit requirement has a disparate impact. So I think the courts intuitively will be looking for a way to cabin, even if they're willing to give some rein to a disparate impact theory of new vote denial, I don't think they would want every single potential voting practice to be analyzed in those terms. And so then I think we would need to know which ones get subjected to this disparate impact theory and which ones don't. So, but I think it is a fruitful line of inquiry as to just how that might come up. And I don't think the courts can avoid it. I mean, they could cut it off at the pass, but that would at least be a holding on that. I mean, it's out there. The tools are there. It's going to be decided. And Steve, did you?
I was just thinking about a question that piggybacks on Richard's comment about the arguable inconsistency, even among individual justices' approaches to these questions. And Ned, you suggested that one response might involve the theory of the First Amendment and its different implications in these areas. But I was just wondering whether another defense of a willingness to be much more intrusive in reviewing the legislative judgment about districting and less willing to review the legislative judgments about campaign finance might have to do with the fact that the decision to create legislative districts is not a legislative judgment. The first order of the legislature is not deciding to create districts. That's an imperative that is already there. They've got to deal with it. Whereas the decision to impose campaign finance restrictions this is my question really, a first order decision the legislature is making, and that someone might be more deferential on that basis.
Yeah, I mean, the comment I wanted to make is quite similar in some ways to Steve's, but tries to make the comment as comprehensive across the field. Dan went very fast past his slide about the first, second, and third generations of voting. But one of the things that's interesting is, first of all of those generations are back on the table now in a way that they weren't, say, 5 years ago. There are hard questions on all of them. And one of the things that I think we found, and this goes back to Heather's comment about intent standards and why the court likes those, is with the exception of one person, one vote, there are no legal theories that are affirmative theories. They're all negative theories. That is, these are the reasons you can't use. These are the things you can't do, without a theory of the affirmative obligation. And one thing I struggled with and didn't put in my paper because I couldn't figure out how to do it exactly is something quite like what you were talking about, Steve, which is if you wanted to give a coherent account of Justice Scalia, you might say, well, if you think about campaign finance, the alternative to having a campaign finance regime is the market. So you could just strike down everything and let the free market and money do what it wants. The alternative to any particular districting plan is not to go to the market, because there isn't a market out there. It is a politically created system. And so I think one of the things the justices find hard, and certainly I find very hard once you get beyond race and racial representation, is to have any strong across-the-board affirmative theory. And I think the one place where we may start to find that is in the first-generation cases, if we move to a point at which there's a kind of consensus that all citizens who meet the following criteria should be able to vote, and then you get things like Sam's proposal in the Boston Review and some of the other ones, that the government should set up affirmative voting lists and they should be responsible for keeping them there, and they should be responsible for making sure everybody who wants to vote can vote. But beyond that, I don't know what the affirmative theories are, and given that we have three generations of issues on the table, we have, and this goes back to Sam's paper, I guess, from yesterday, a system that's in real volatility now along a lot of dimensions. It's really hard to know what to do if you don't have an affirmative theory and all you have is a series of negative theories that allow you to pick off particular parts of the problem with respect to claims of particular groups.
Can I just add also one thing? This is a court that really hasn't had its head, hasn't been able to run with any particular theory, because both sides, it's just to go back to Ned's original point, both sides have been handicapped, in fact, by having a center, and centers tend to be less coherent, and especially when you have a pragmatic center. So for the last, 15, 20 years, both sides have labored under the need to put together five votes. If suddenly one side is given five real votes, whichever side it is, and they don't have to sort of, play to the middle, we may see more, who knows, but we may see more coherence coming out of their opinions.
Do you think anybody, gives me is, I don't have a theory of all of this stuff. So I don't know if any.
That's fair enough. Like, all right.
I think you have to take kind of Richard's point. If one side had, if it were not as silly as, we would get a body of doctrine about dissents and so forth. But I don't think it would get at Richard's point.
No, that's
point,
fair enough.
Which is they realize at some level that they're still grappling with these very fundamental questions about democratic legitimacy, and they don't know A, what that means, and B, where courts fit in exactly. And so that's why you get this, Scalia on one question is inconsistent with Scalia on another. Maybe Pam's argument is right, that the theory is that courts should stay out unless, if there's another avenue,
I guess it's the argument that we do have a campaign finance law, it's called the First Amendment, and that otherwise, this is sort of, I guess, where Steve was going, that there's a Ned, that there is, Constitution resolves campaign finance, but we don't have it. A constitutional representation.
Which is her reading of Scalia, which is the fact that campaign finance law is the market. Every governmental intervention is prohibited because either the First Amendment or because the market actually promptly handles this matter.
Well, the other thing is if you tell the government they have to stay out, there's a domain, and that is people have their money from the property rules. Whereas if you said the government has to stay out of districting, what does that mean?
I want to...
Yeah. There will be some coherence.
That's the lack of cross nine, cross five coherence, as opposed to internally coherence. Yeah. If the inability to assemble majorities on any of these major points, or the majority they do assemble, accept basic schizophrenia as the acceptance of the most rejected contribution expenditure distinction, but the court accepts it because of the way that the court works.
This is also Michael's point about democratic contestation within the court. Right. If it was just Scalia sitting alone, judgment. The fact that he has to work in a coalition is what raises these new issues, and that's so you have an institutional framework for your theory.
And believe it or not, I want to tie this last line of discussions back to Michael's paper on cert granting and the docket control, because it seems to me that a court that is either internally incoherent in the sense that every justice is incoherent or even cross-justice incoherent. They don't have a theory. It's hard stuff. I wonder whether that's a court that should be in control of its own docket to the extent that it is. In other words, I think I don't know that it's a bad thing. This is echoing Richard's question of Michael in the earlier session. Is it such a terrible thing that the court is forced to confront fact patterns that might not be its preferred fact patterns or in the order that it has to take them? I mean, the most interesting single development in the mess that resulted from this term that's garnered the most, you know, in many ways people have talked about fruitful commentary was the District 23 ruling, which was the surprise. That was not what that case was intended to be about. It's probably not what cert would have been granted on. And I don't think it's just that we're academics and like novel things that were unexpected and they're creative. I think that was law generation of a kind that the court might not have wanted to generate for itself, but it might be bad for the country for the reasons that Guy suggested. It might be good for the country for reasons. But it's interesting in a way that the court didn't get to decide what law to create. On the other hand, Randall was a case where it got to decide, and I think cert got granted in part because they wanted to slap down the Second Circuit. You know, it may be better that they're forced to confront Austin and McConnell not on their own terms, but on the terms that Congress has imposed and that the environment of litigation in the real world imposes. So I think there is a deep connection between the substance and the incoherence and the procedure, which may be a nice thought to tie some strands together with. Any?
Well, that's a really interesting idea, but it is in tension with another idea, which is until the court has thought about the issues and there's been enough percolation of the issues and a lot of fact patterns for them to look at, saying you're going to have to decide an issue nationwide with the first fact pattern that gets up to you, right, closes off the door for a lot of discussion. I mean, to some extent, you know, people who've criticized the court's immediate rush from Baker to Reynolds to one person, one vote, one of the criticisms is you should have given the states some time to come up with a bunch of different things and then looked and said, well, you know, is a Senate model for some states sensible? Are there states where there are regional variations in the density of population that make it sensible to say we're not going to require one congressman to, you know, if you look up there, there are like two congressmen representing three quarters of the map of Texas. Maybe that's not a good thing, right? So that on the one hand, the forcing forces them to answer the questions and doesn't allow them to duck it. On the other hand, to the extent that you think there'd be some wisdom from having lots of judges talk about the issue before the final decision is raised, mandatory appellate review cuts off percolation.
Well, we've come, in a sense, we've come full circle in that we started out talking about percolation in the first panel and whether and how much percolation there should be and is that a good or bad thing. And it's probably good to end on the note that we aren't resolving everything. The conversation will continue. And absolutely. So I do want, is Matt Byrne in the room somewhere? I can't. All right, stand up, Matt, because we really... And is Irene around? I know, I see Laura. We should do the same for Laura. If Irene were here, we would do the same. And Anne Brace also, who's been... come on in. So see you on the in cyberspace for a continuation of conversations.
Richard, your comments at the end were so helpful. I think.